the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It is 7:30 on this Monday morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. I would say it's a regular two-hour show for you this morning, but it's going to be anything but regular. We're going to have the usual coronavirus updates over the course of the first hour or so of the show. We're going to have a couple of guests talking to us about how their businesses have been affected, sports-related guests. And then for the last hour or so, or the last 45 minutes at least, we will turn the coronavirus tap off for you this morning and turn our attention towards the Classic Game Club. It's our podcast series that's been running for the duration of 2020 so far. We're going to ratchet this up a little bit over the next few weeks. Today's edition is Meath against Cork, the 1990 All-Ireland Football Final, the year Cork did the double. A fantastic morning for any Cork GAA fans joining us. We would love to hear from you this morning. You can tweet us at Off The Ball. You can get in touch with what you're doing, what have you been getting up to over the course of the weekend, any stories or anecdotes from lockdown over the past couple of days. As I say, it's not a regular show. Nathan Murphy should be in this seat this morning, but instead he's at home. How are you getting on, Nathan?
We're all right. We're getting there. It's a bit unusual, I think, to say the least.
Does it feel like day three at the moment or day 300?
No, it feels very much like day 300. this is going to be a long, long few weeks, I think, for everybody for a whole manner of reasons.
Well, what's your household been like over the last few days?
Well, there's a bit of a novelty factor to it at the moment, but trying to tell three kids that they can't meet up with their friends or they can't go about their daily life is a bit weird. So it's a lot of time spent trying to work out sort of timetables of amusement. There's been a lot of table tennis.
Okay.
My wife, fair play to her, just out of pure luck, had bought a little nice little table tennis set that you can attach to your own kitchen table, which if anybody's watching, I would heartily recommend buying. So we have a morning table tennis competition and quite often an afternoon table tennis competition. There have been tears every morning so far, but I'm hopeful they may stop at some stage. There have been colouring competitions. You name it, it's a competition, which is a dangerous route to go down because somebody ends up crying.
I'm really jealous of your kids.
That they get the morning table tennis competition.
Morning table tennis competition sounds absolutely fantastic, I'm not going to lie.
I'm just trying to stay away from buying a PlayStation for as long as possible.
I hear you.
Because that'd be the easy answer, but yeah, let's try and avoid that.
Because, of course, buying a PlayStation would be just for your kids and definitely not just to satisfy your own boredom.
Exactly, yeah.
Perilously close to installing the... Actually, no, not perilously close. I downloaded 15% of Fortnite last Thursday on my PC. I don't know if you can actually even play it, but I just saw that there was like a Mac version and I stopped myself. I was like, no, this is, at the time it was day one. I was like, this is too soon. Give me another few weeks of this before I actually delve into the world of Fortnite. I think I speak for a lot of people here. Once you start on something like that, you will not be able to stop. We will never be able to come out of the funk we will find ourselves in if we started something like Football Manager or Fortnite or something like that. What have you been doing? What has Nathan Murphy been doing to keep himself busy rather than just his kids?
Unfortunately, when you have three kids under eight, your entire day pretty much goes into... So there's... Yeah, it's watch a movie at night. So what have I watched so far? Last night I watched the first Lego movie again. Have you watched the Lego movies?
I've seen the first one. Excellent.
Well, the second one is actually better.
Is it?
But I watched the first one again. Second one is quality. So by second one, I mean the Lego Movie Part 2.
Mm.
So not Lego Batman, which is technically the second one, but which is also good because Batman's probably the best character in the Lego movies. I watched The Lion King the night before that, the new version of The Lion King, which is rather bizarre because it's the exact same movie. Just live action, which, while impressive, I would have thought maybe they might have tried something a little bit different.
Mm.
What else have I watched? The Smurfs movie.
Okay, how's that?
Not great. Kids loved it, but there's no real adult side to it at all. So any recommendations out there, please, I'm open. Trying to get kids to watch something new is difficult. So like, I've never seen Star Wars, so I'm trying to convince them to sit and watch all the Star Wars, but that's just difficult. Or watch all the Harry Potters. Get into something.
Yeah, that would be...
I also have visions of... I've been telling them like maybe they could learn the guitar over the next couple of months.
Okay.
Or learn Spanish or something and come out of this with something positive. But they have shown little interest in that so far.
That is the thing. If there's a couple of bad aspects to social media at the moment, first of all is the rumours and stuff that you see around social media that is obviously bad. But second of all is the pressure it is putting on people. It is like in the year 1400 and something, William Shakespeare was quarantined and wrote King Lear. Or Isaac Newton invented the theory of gravity while quarantined or something like that. There's a lot of pressure on us to actually achieve something good. The guitar might actually be up there. It's a good shout.
What have you been doing?
I've been watching a lot of Dream Team, which is something that I've quickly realised is not the best way to spend some time. But I'm in there. I've started writing pieces for Off the Ball on this, so I'm kind of a little bit in too deep to actually undo this at the moment. Watching a lot of Better Call Saul, which is...
Okay.
I just can't believe I haven't done this before, really. It's outrageous that a Breaking Bad fan could even have been left off the hook not watching this thing, because it is funnier than Breaking Bad. I would say even in the early stages, if you compare early season to early seasons, it's better than Breaking Bad. And we want to have a little bit more of that as the weeks go on, because I think Jerry's binge-watching that as well at the moment. But as Nathan said, we'd love to hear your recommendations. Tweet us at Off The Ball. Tweet us personally if you want. What have you been watching? What have you been binging on? Of course, over the course of last night, we've been watching a bit of 90s football. We will have more on that later on when Tommy Rooney will be joining us for a Classic Game Club. Let us tell you the full schedule of what's coming up this morning on OTBAM. The running order this morning is looking something like this. Sports pages coming your way at 20 to 8 this morning. The GEA Impact then. Brian Farrell and Paul Ganey will be joining us after 8 o'clock. Former Meath footballer and, of course, current Kerry footballer. Both publicans will be telling us about the impact in their business that the coronavirus has had over the last few days. The sports news with Tom Malone coming your way at 8:30. And then the Classic Game Club at 8:45. This morning. It's Cork against Meath in the 1990 All-Ireland Final. Just to tell you what's coming up today in sport, there is ridiculously live sport to tell you about, because Emmett Brennan will face a Swiss opponent in the last 16 of the Olympic qualifiers in London today. The Dublin Docklands boxing club man. He needs a top six finish to qualify for Tokyo. He's back in action tomorrow, St. Patrick's Day against Switzerland, Uke Smalley. He was joined in the last 16 by Tala lightweight George Bates and Dublin heavyweight Kirill Afanas Aval. And today in London, Aidan Walsh and Michael Nevin are fighting for places in the last 16, with all bouts behind closed doors from now on. Brendan Irvine, Carly McNall and Kurt Walker are fighting for places in the last 8 of qualifying. Now, in football, Manchester United's Paul Pogba has pledged financial support to help fight the coronavirus pandemic. He set up a fundraising page on Facebook and said he'll double the amount raised if the £27,000 target is reached. Now, former Manchester City defender Elikim Mangala is one of five Valencia players and staff to test positive for coronavirus. Ezekiel Garay is another, and Mangala says he's self-isolating, and the club says all the individuals are in good health. A couple of other stories to tell you about. The Rugby Union Premiership season is expected to be suspended. A meeting set to take place today to discuss the best way forward for league fixtures due to coronavirus concerns. Of course, the United Kingdom have yet to do what we have done, and in terms of banning public gatherings of huge numbers like that. The final round of Six Nations matches were postponed, of course. World Cup winner Will Greenwood, you can check out his comments on offtheball.com if you want to see his. He says basically there will be an opportunity to play Saturday's fixtures on the 31st of October. And then in snooker, Judd Trump has made history in winning snooker's Gibraltar Open last night. The world number one beat Kyron Wilson 4-3 in the decider to become the first player to win 6 ranking titles in a single season. The final was played behind closed doors due to the coronavirus, with Trump picking up £50,000 in prize money, as well as £150,000. You can contact us as well this morning on WhatsApp, I should say. It's 087-9180-180. That's 087-9180-180. Time for the papers. OTB AM. We'll start with offtheball.com. First this morning, he was called Judas. Jack Charlton's complicated relationship with Ireland. Ross Whittaker was on Off The Ball over the course of the weekend, chatting about his Italian 90 doc. It's absolutely fantastic. Worth checking out the interview as well. Definitely worth your time as well. Up on YouTube right now, or as I say, on offtheball.com. Right, let's start through some of the back pages this morning. I'm going to start with the Irish Daily Mail this morning, because this has obviously been a big story that's doing the rounds over the last 24 hours. Fury could be hit with 8-year ban. UK anti-doping set to open new probe after a claim member of his team offered Farmer £25,000 to lie about failed drugs tests. So this is a story that the Irish Mail on Sunday obviously led with and had as an exclusive yesterday. So if anybody's missed this, basically the story this morning is that UCAT are poised to open a new investigation into Tyson Fury and his cousin Huey, because explosive allegations about a member of their team offered a farmer $25,000 to lie about how the pair failed dope tests in 2015. So this is with regards to nandrolone potentially being contaminated in meat. The allegation, and I should say that it is an allegation, is that a farmer was paid to lie about nandrolone being in the meat. So interesting to see what the UCAN investigation shows up. Also very, very interesting to hear what the Fury response will be. Frank Warren has come out and categorically denied this story, has rubbished it, has said it is completely ridiculous. So it's important to put that out there at the moment today. Completely deny this. The other story in the back of the Irish Daily Mail, which might miss people's attention today, is that FAI to approve rescue deal by email. Philip Quinn reporting that the €50 million rescue deal for the FAI is to be approved by email today. It was, of course, supposed to be agreed in person in the Castleknock Hotel. 79 delegates, putting them in a room wouldn't be very safe, so they're going to try and do it over email today. Gary Owens last night requested them to do it. He says that it is essential that this council sanction is received tomorrow, so that's today, to keep the association alive. So the full terms of the deal entail extending the maturity date of the primary $28.5 million loan and the Aviva Stadium borrowings from 2021 to 2030. On top of that then, an upfront $14 million loan is being supplied for cash flow purposes, and that'll be repaid at €2.5 million per annum directly from the UEFA centralised TV deal. And then there is also the option until December 2021 of increasing this loan by €10 million. So I'm not sure that you see this coming, Nathan. Like, this is obviously a story that we've that hasn't exactly been front and centre over the last few weeks, but this is obviously a deal that needs to be signed, sealed and delivered, and today is the day to do it.
Well, I think the FAI realises there's a real rush on this because we're in totally uncharted territory where the government are dipping into essentially all their savings funds. They've gone into the Brexit fund and they're throwing absolutely everything at fighting this outbreak. So if the FAI don't have that in writing, you can understand why they're in a bit of a rush to get it done, because obviously this is still a, listen, it's a worrying time for everybody in any form of employment, and the FAI need to get these funds in just for pure cash flow purposes. This obviously won't do very much for League of Ireland clubs, which, you know, we can get onto later. The treasurer of Sligo Rovers was on with Neil Tracy on Saturday and was very interesting in terms of just their cash flow issues that will come up very, very quickly. And Sligo, a very well-run club. But I just think for FAI, for clubs, like, this is where UEFA and FIFA need to step up. These are two incredibly wealthy organisations. And that's going to be one of the interesting things to follow over the next few weeks. You know, do UEFA, do the governing bodies step in and help the weaker clubs, the weaker leagues, and make sure that they survive? Or is it going to be a survival of the fittest in sport?
Yeah, it'll be very, very interesting to see what does happen over the next few weeks. One of the interesting things from the paper today is just kind of a cut down on the amount of supplements available. Irish Examiner usually has a separate sports section every morning. Naturally now, I've just gone back into the rest of the paper because there is a lack of sport to report on. And they do say there are strange days in worrying times, and positional switch for Examiner Sport. Applause now reserved for medical heroes is the top line here. Dermot Corrigan reporting on a fairly grim situation in Madrid at the moment. And damn the begrudgers, we've had a great season no matter how it finishes. So this is a Liverpool perspective on how the season has gone. Obviously, the potential for the season to be called off and postponed, or whatever way you want to look at it, depending if you're Karen Brady or Jurgen Klopp, there are varying degrees of whether or not you want the season called off. We'll get into that shortly. Just to go through the rest of the back pages. The back page of the Irish Sun: four teams, 5 days, one stadium. UEFA's quickfire idea for European competitions to be fully completed. So this could be almost a mini tournament to complete the UEFA Champions League and Europa League this summer. The Champions League would take place in Istanbul. The Europa League would take place in Gdansk. And it'll be played over the course of a little mini tournament, really. Alan Shearer then writing, Prem KO is last option. But if so, no title or drop. We'll get Nathan's take on that in just a moment. The Daily Telegraph, inside their main newspaper section as well this morning. UEFA moves to save Champions League. As I mentioned there, the semi-finals and final could be staged over 4 days. One last punch-up. Castleford beat St Helens in probably the final rugby league game for a while. And US to bid for T20 World Cup as co-hosts. And players fear for future after virus shutdown. Moving on to The Guardian then this morning. They lead with that fairly striking picture from Brazil last night. Masked fury in Brazil. Gremio players protest in striking fashion over having to play amid virus pandemic. And then they also have that Tyson Fury story. UCAD posed to investigate boxer over farmer's meat claim. The Irish Daily Star then. Declan's careless kickabout. Rice practiced despite coronavirus order against Pal Mount. So a passerby yesterday spotted two figures playing a bit of football in the training ground and discovered that Mason Mount was one of the footballers playing a bit of ball with his buddy Declan Rice. Of course, Mason Mount is supposed to be self-isolating at the moment after Callum Hudson-Odoi tested positive for coronavirus. Idiots is the headline there, as you can see in the UK version of the Star this morning. They've gone for a harder line. Carl O'Kane has an exclusive here with former Derry star Paddy Bradley. Mixed messages, a big problem. So this is between the mixed messages north and south of the border over the coronavirus. He says they are crazy. He's a secondary school teacher and he cannot understand why educational institutions in the UK and Northern Ireland have not been closed yet, despite GEA clubs all over the country going into lockdown. The Herald this morning goes with Euro loser. UEFA asked to postpone finals. And 30 years of hurt. Irish trio look back at the 1990 season when Liverpool last won the league. The Mirror then goes with the Mason Mount story as well. Selfish isolation. And Rooney says we're guinea pigs. This is Wayne Rooney in the Sunday Times yesterday, wondering why footballers were used as guinea pigs and initially asked to play last weekend. Begovic then says we must finish the season and bring joy. Players demanding that football authorities find a way to finish this season. The Irish Independent then. GEA warn of stark risks facing players who defy blanket ban. So club or inter-county teams that continue to train during the 17-day suspension of GEA activity will not be insured, putting players at considerable risk. Picture there of a lock in front of Croke Park. The Irish Times then this morning, leading with a photo from the boxing yesterday. Incredible that that is still continuing to go ahead. Boxing qualifiers continue, but uncertainty still for many athletes, writes Ian O'Riordan. Situation in athletics complicated by the introduction of new qualifying criteria. While Malachy Clerkin says lockdown will highlight how important sport is in our lives, and Van Dijk fears winning title in empty stadium, which is looking like a possibility for Liverpool at this point. And then finally for now, the London Times. Fury faces new drug probe. Key witness claims he lied to anti-doping officials. Warren says allegations are outrageous. You've got the photographs there of Brazilian team Grêmio wearing masks in coronavirus protest, and you have to complete the season, says Greg Dyke. And Nathan, we may go straight into this story on the back of it, because there's clearly a lot of vested interests at play here. Karen Brady, the one and the strongest voice really to kind of step out of line and say, nah, we should actually just wrap things up, or just void everything, I should say, for this season, which is obviously convenient given West Ham United are in a bit of relegation trouble. Like, you've got Greg Dyke, you've got his successor Greg Clark saying that he's going to tell clubs that he believes it will be unfeasible to finish the season. So not, you don't just have Karen Brady saying this, you do have someone like Greg Clark saying this might not actually happen, getting this whole thing finished.
It may well be unfeasible to finish the season because we don't know how long this is going to last. And if we get deep into the summer, when are you going to finish the season? And for Greg Dyke saying you must finish the season, I think it's way too early to say you got to do anything right now. We just don't know where we're going to be in a month, in 2 months' time. So the Premier League, it seems, are going to make a decision this week. And any decision that goes with continuing to play or intending to play games behind closed doors, they're going to have to come back to that, you'd imagine, in times to come. And this idea of playing behind closed doors seems to ignore, and it touches on what Wayne Rooney said yesterday, seems to ignore the fact that, firstly, as we've seen from Spain, that this disease can affect anybody, that it can affect players, it can affect their family members, that they're just going to turn up 11v11 and rock on and play the game for our entertainment and deal with the consequences as if it's somehow going to affect them slightly differently. Like, that's just not going to happen. And also, and this was shown in the PGA Tour where they intended to play on behind closed doors, it's not just 11v11. You've got management, backroom staff, and from a broadcaster's point of view, I'm sure dozens upon dozens of people. So suddenly you're very quickly into 100, 150 people into a stadium, and suddenly you're into a mass gathering again where people can't stay that far apart. So to suggest we can just go back, I think, in 2 months' time playing these games behind closed doors, I just don't think it's a runner at all. The one possibility that the Premier League could go, and the Champions League is, I would imagine, something that maybe the Premier League might think about as well, of running it off over 4 or 5 days whenever you can. So do you look at the league table, and there's so many politics involved in all this, and you talk about Karen, like when Karen Brady talks about voiding the season, does she intend to give Sky back the 120 million that they got in the broadcasting rights? Absolutely not. They intend to keep all the money for the season and make sure they're getting it again next season. I've seen a 22-team league proposed where Leeds and West Brom will come in, that there's no relegation. Like, all, everything is going to be on the table over the next while. The most obvious pressing issue is what they do with Liverpool and whether they give them the title. Right now, it sort of feels irrelevant. It feels like the sort of age of banter is going to be put on pause for a little while. And a lot of what has been spoken about with Liverpool is the sort of banter side of things of Manchester United, Manchester City supporters. Can they sort of get one over on Liverpool? In one way, it feels like it doesn't really matter. If you put a giant asterisk, I think everybody's going to remember and recognise that Liverpool should have won the title. They're 25 points clear. It's not like at this stage they're going to win the title the way they want to, which is in front of a packed house like they might have this weekend against Crystal Palace. It's not like they're going to have that open top parade anytime soon, but there's no question they are the champions. And like, could you look at a situation where you look down the league and say, all right, Liverpool are champions, Manchester City and Leicester City get into Europe next season, and then it's very tight below that, and you have a 6-team tournament to get the final Champions League spot, and maybe you have some sort of an 8-team tournament for relegation. You see, the teams in the bottom half, they all will want it to be null and void and just rock on next season and keep things going. So there's probably there is no right thing to do at the moment, but I could definitely see a situation. I'd say the most likely scenario right now is that they just void the season.
I wonder, is there a possibility, or I don't wonder, I think it's definitely going to be the case, if football comes back in the next couple of months, that it just becomes a hierarchy of which has the most money associated with it. So Champions League has got the most money going around for it. So that will be the first in line to get its little mini tournament sorted. So you'll get rid of two-legged ties. You'll just have them played off in a sort of March Madness type thing in the middle of the summer, potentially, as I say, if football comes back. Then the next thing down the line would be the Premier League finishing it up, or at least finishing it to the point where Liverpool are clear winners and have it mathematically wrapped up. And then you kind of go down the rung as well, where the FA Cup would probably just be scrapped entirely. And then you kind of have this international window like that. Like, I would be astonished at this point if it is not Euro 2021. There can't be any feasible way how Euro 2020 goes ahead in this climate.
No, there's absolutely no chance, particularly because that it's in 12 different countries and the sheer amount of travelling that's going to take place. So, yeah, you're right. It will be a hierarchy, and it's a similar situation going back to golf in that it looks as though all four majors are probably going to be postponed. Are they going to be just that asterisk, which again, I wouldn't have a big issue with, or does money talk? And actually, when golf hopefully returns, say August, September, do you have four majors in the space of 6 weeks? Because that's where the most money is. So it'll be a similar situation. The Champions League will definitely take precedence, but how long can you go on for? So if you have the Champions League and you're going to have three or four games in the space of 4 or 5 days, there's a week gone. Yeah. If the Premier League, a lot of the teams still have what? 9-10 games left. At a minimum, that's going to take 5 weeks to run off. Like, next thing you're into next September. Now, Wayne Rooney touched on it. Maybe you just reshape the calendar and the build-up to the 2022 World Cup, and you use this opportunity now to do that. And I'd imagine nothing is really off the table at the moment. But it right now, it really doesn't seem feasible to play off the final 10 games of the Premier League season. And if that's the case, how can you relegate any teams? And if you're not going to have relegation, can you have a champion?
As you say, it's a small change in comparison to everything else that's going on, but like, one of the things that will be of major interest to Irish football fans is who will be managing the team going into next year. And it's something that Eamon Sweeney is writing about in the Irish Independent this morning. He's making the point that it's just time to bring Stephen Kenny in right now. It's kind of like, tough luck, just let, if there is a new football season from, say, August, September this year, just let Stephen Kenny be the manager, even if that requires going into the same European campaign.
I wouldn't agree with that. Like, I think saying tough luck to anybody about anything right now isn't really the attitude that people need to have. Mick McCarthy has a job to do, which is to bring the sides to the European Championship final. And I think he should be given the chance to see that out. We're pressing pause on football at the moment. We can't just say that the football is stopping, but everything else will continue. So Mick McCarthy should 100% be given the playoffs. And if it doesn't go right, well, Stephen Kenny will come in straight away. Again, tomorrow, maybe we'll find out a bit more about when they intend to play these playoffs. But if Mick McCarthy qualifies and gets through against Slovakia and Bosnia or Northern Ireland, to take that away and say, well, actually, your contract's up, tough luck because of this once-in-a-generation situation we've found herself in, I would say is totally unfair. And listen, I'm very much on the Stephen Kenny bandwagon and would love to see him in as soon as possible. But I think you've got to do the right thing. You can't say, let's do the right thing in all aspects of life and all aspects of society, except for the little bits we don't like, and take a little shortcut here. The FAI are going to find themselves in that difficult situation. Stephen Kenny's contract says, I think, the 1st of August 2020 is when he starts the job. But lots of people have contracts right now that are going to have to be renegotiated in every single walk of life. And to suggest that if Ireland qualify, that Mick McCarthy wouldn't be the manager, I just don't think is right or fair. And I don't know what Stephen Kenny's attitude, like, he's looking at this, I'm sure, thinking, my contract is. But also, he very much lives in the real world, and we'll see what is happening. And is he going to try and step in and force the issue if the Republic of Ireland qualify? It's Mick's team. This team, whether we like it or not, and quite often we don't like it, is Mick McCarthy's team. If he gets them to Euro 2021, as it'll probably be, he deserves to be the manager.
I think Mick, you have to let Mick follow this thing through. This is the entire agreement. The agreement wasn't really based on a date. It was based on the end point of an entire process. And I think you've got to let him finish it out. You've got to let him see out the playoffs at the very least. Just a couple of other things to wrap up on. Then, like Jack Anderson writing in the Irish Examiner this morning about the immunity of the Olympics, that there still has been no budging whatsoever. The Prime Minister of Japan has come out and said, everything is fine. Everything will be going ahead. Which is astonishing, really, because there is still a lot of loose ends to be tied up when it comes to Olympic qualification, not least what is happening right now in London with an Olympic qualifier event. You've got the likes of Kurt Walker going out to fight for his place in the Olympics today. And it comes back to the point that you make about, you know, like Wayne Rooney and guinea pigs and all that sort of thing. If footballers are being sent out there to play against one another, boxers going into a boxing ring, and, you know, we talk about the droplets being exchanged by human beings in regular conversation being detrimental to everybody's health. The droplets being exchanged in a boxing ring, you can only imagine. I just can't get my head around the fact that this is going ahead. Like, even in fairness to the Ireland boxing team, they cut short their own training camp in Italy because of this. Now, obviously, this is a continental and a global pandemic at this point. It's just beyond belief that this thing is happening. Like, you can't blame them for actually going forward and ensuring that their boxers are still in the competition, because it is their one and only chance to qualify for the Olympic Games. But this is just this wide invincibility complex that the Olympics seems to have, which is ludicrous at this point.
Well, it needs to be taken out of the sports people's hands. And it needs to be taken out of the sports administrators' hands. But the problem is that the British government have decided to go down a very different path to our government and governments around the world. And we may all pay the price for that, it feels. We saw what happened at Cheltenham last week. We saw what happened at Anfield. The amount of people coming together. We don't know what the outcome of that is going to be. And the fear is that, obviously, the British government have hung their people out to dry. But because we're such close neighbours, that we're going to feel the ramifications of that as well. But there's so many parts of what's going on across the water that are just so strange. You're watching television, British television, and I was watching Question Time on Thursday night, and they spoke about the coronavirus for 4 or 5 questions, and there just didn't seem to be a full awareness of the gravity of the situation that there was here. You're, flicked on Ant and Dec Saturday Night Takeaway. And there is a full audience of 300 or 400 people. Ant and Dec starting the show with a hand sanitizer joke. It just doesn't seem to have computed as to what is going on. And that obviously comes from the very top. And this attitude of, well, we're going to enjoy it while we can. And eventually when they press stop, then we'll take it seriously. And listen, maybe you do. Maybe that's what's happened in this country, that ever since, really, Thursday morning when Leo Varadkar made that speech in Washington, the people have fully copped on to what's going on here and have taken it very, very seriously. But it's just the fact that we're only, 3-4 days on from that Britain has such a different attitude. And it's a terrible, horrible position for the boxers to be put in, especially considering I don't think anyone believes that the Olympics are going to take place as they're meant to. Perhaps later in the year, obviously in Asia, thankfully it feels as though maybe they're moving on to a slightly different stage of this outbreak and are starting to get some sort of containment. But how can you have an Olympic Games if this isn't contained in every single part of the world, if we aren't pretty much totally through this crisis? I don't think you can have an Olympic Games, and it certainly goes against the Olympic spirit, if you were to say, well, you know, we're going to let in these 60 countries who have done things right and who have got on top of this pandemic, but the other countries, tough luck, you're not coming. I don't think that's feasible. And there's sponsors, there's money. Maybe there's probably many reasons why the Japanese feel they have to keep saying it's going to happen on for as long as possible, but deep down they must know there's not a hope in hell it's going to happen.
Well, like, it's a good point that you make. If things are actually in a very different scenario over there than they are here, maybe the Japanese Prime Minister is the last person you need to be hearing from in this case, because this is not a Japanese event. This is a global event. This is about the world. This is about where the epicenter of this pandemic is at the moment. And athletes who are in grave danger at the moment, really, by going into a boxing ring, for example, to puck the heads off one another, rather than a situation where maybe the location is going to be safe come August. Like, that is the important thing. It is the safety of the athletes, where they are at the moment, as opposed to how Japan is fixed at the moment, which, as you say, is getting a little bit better. But we might come back to that before the end of the show. As you mentioned, a fairly terrible situation as well in the UK at the moment. We'll be chatting to Enda Stevens shortly as well. But next up, we're chatting to Brian Farrell and Paul Gainey. Brian Farrell is a former Meath footballer, of course. Paul Gainey, current Kerry footballer. They are both publicans. They'll be talking to us about the recent decision to inform all pubs around Ireland to close business for the foreseeable future. Before we get on to the lads, let's just play you this from Cliona O'Connor on the Sunday pay-per-view yesterday. She reflected on a surprisingly good debut column from Wayne Rooney in the Sunday Times. We don't have that. We'll come back to that in just a moment. We'll go straight to an ad break, actually, and we'll be back in a sec.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
OTB Sports Radio. Football never stops, and neither do we.
Don't shoot.
Oh, he dinked it. Oh!
It's a goal! The Football Show is the only place to get the best analysis.
We've tried this way, and we've been trying it for a long time.
Just after process, though.
Best interviews.
There was talk that you used to go commando when you played, and
yeah, I did. Yeah, I never wore pants. Still don't wear pants.
And best opinions and all things from across the pond and here in Ireland. Live every night from 9 PM on OTB Sports Radio.
Television all the time.
Get OTB Sports Radio online at offtheball.com/radio or on your phone by downloading the Go Loud app. The OTB Brief. Everything you need to know about sport every morning. Need to get on top of the day's sports news? Well, the OTB Brief is the only sports update you'll need every morning. With all the breaking stories, post-match reaction.
They had one more day to rest. We were really in trouble to build the team.
And the best bits from Off the Ball, all in a 10-minute podcast.
Oh, sweaty palms. Of course, you guys know what it's like, but... That was nervy, yeah.
The OTB Brief, online every morning from 7 AM on offtheball.com, the Go Loud app, and everywhere you get your podcasts.
OTB AM.
It is 4 minutes past 8 on this Monday morning. You're watching OTB AM. You can tweet us at Off the Ball if you've got any comments or questions for us this morning. We're with you until 9:30. Right, we're turning our attention to the publicans and those running pubs that have been affected by the coronavirus outbreak over the past couple of days. We've got two big GAA names on the line. We've got former Meath footballer Brian Farrell on the line and also current Kerry footballer Paul Gainey on the line. Good morning to you, lads. You're very welcome.
Good morning. How are you going
on? Brian, we might start with you. You might just explain to us the last few days for you personally and for your business.
Yeah, so I suppose the landscape's been changing by two or three times every day. So kind of at the end of last week, we kind of knew we were under pressure kind of to stay open and that it was probably going to be only a matter of time. And you were kind of seeking some direction on it. Direction, to be honest with you, was slow. Coming from the government, because they obviously have a lot more on their plate. So the decision was kind of made Saturday evening that we had to kind of act on it, and we made the decision Saturday night that when we closed the door, that was going to be it until further notice, in order to, I suppose, protect our staff, protect our customers, and just to do the right thing, you know.
So your pub is a small rural pub, and I take it on a regular, say, weekday night and maybe even on a weekend night, there will be less than the 100 people in your pub.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And like, I suppose when it was kind of a little bit jokey kind of in the middle of last week, the joke was that we'd put, if we got over 100, we'd put the balance of the people out into the shed and they'd have to wait to come in. But I suppose that never materialised. You know, we had to take everything so serious. So, yeah, you would always be less than 100, and it'd be pure kind of people within your 4 or 5 mile radius that would be coming into you anyhow.
But even with the number half of 100, like 100 was always going to be a strange number for a pub like yours to deal with, because practicing, say, social distancing, you'd need a fraction of that, I would have assumed.
Yeah, but like, what is it? Like, what is the social distancing? Is something that we've just heard in the last 3 or 4 days. You know, we've never really encountered that before. And as a country, let's be honest about it. We don't do social distancing. It's all in or nothing, isn't it? Really. Mm. So it was always going to be a challenge, you know. But it's like if someone says, was it a hard decision? It's not, because as I heard someone before saying, it's completely the right decision, you know. And it's kind of we'll get by. Like, you've got. Most publicans probably have got maybe 3 to 4 weeks, if lucky, of kind of a cash flow. But it's the employees around the country, you know, and our employees that you really, really fear for, you know.
I might just bring Paul Gainey in on that. Paul, good morning to you.
Morning.
Would you be on the same page as Brian there that this is the right decision? I presume there might have been a few stag parties and stuff like that filtering through Dingle over the course of the weekend.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly the right decision. I suppose I would echo Brian's on just the lateness of it. And I suppose a lot of people are still unaware how severe the situation was. And it kind of became more clear as the weekend was going. We had a lot of cancellations on the Friday and that. And you could see that it was going to be a lot quieter. It would have been an extremely busy weekend for us otherwise. But then, you know, you could see Friday night was quiet enough. And then Saturday, you could see as the day was going on that policing, that, you know, the social distancing was going to be difficult. And while we didn't have anywhere near 100, you know, people, I suppose, as the night went on with drink on board, just were in their usual habit of, you know, chatting within a close enough distance. And it was obvious that we were going to have to make a decision anyway, regardless of the government's coming in to close the doors. But it's definitely the right decision. It is difficult for especially the staff, as Brian said. You know, there's not much light shed yet as to what they can do over the next while and what we can do to keep them employed. But we're going to try and do maybe a delivery service this week. We'll try that. I just got the internet up and running there over the weekend to order online, but it'll be difficult enough with the English sparse population, and you know, you're talking about a massive radius of people. But you know, there is an older population as well here, and you feel for those people that are home. Usually will pop into the pub for their sandwich or their dinner, and as far as takeaway options go, there aren't too many facilities down here in Dingle for you know, wholesome meals or you know, your roast of the day and that sort of thing. So we're going to try and provide that for the people of the town. It'd probably be more in our interest to close the door and just shut up shop, but you know, I suppose these things have to be provided for as well in small communities. So I'm sure a lot of pubs, little restaurants as well around the country will provide those sort of you know, services for people over the next while.
Yeah, for sure. I think there was a lot of anger over the course of the weekend when a particular video from Temple Bar in particular went viral, when you had like close to 100 people, I don't know the exact number, singing Sweet Caroline in a pub. Like, obviously you said yourself that you were open on Saturday night and that you were going to come to the decision to close this pub anyway, but I think that there was almost a rush to tar all pubs with the one brush as soon as that video came out.
Yeah, I think it was thrown into the fire as a whole, I think, and I think it was wrong, because the pubs, I'm sure, were doing a lot, you know, that they thought they were doing the right thing, but there wasn't a total, the severity wasn't really made 100% clear. Like, you know, I think that's clear across anything. People standing in shops talking to each other is the same thing, and, you know, on the street, and it's just the, as Ryan said, the people, we didn't know what social distancing was until, you know, a couple of days ago, and that's the whole psyche of it. And then I suppose pubs were an easy target then because of what went on social media, and then the whole lot were tarred with the same brush. So, you know, that's difficult for the industry to take. I'm sure there was many more pubs around the country that were completely fine and would have been fine as well, but I suppose you just can't take the chance anymore. it's an emergency situation now, and it's been made very clear over the weekend. But you know, if that had come a little bit sooner, it might have been easier for people to make those decisions earlier and be more proactive about it. But I suppose it's unprecedented, and the government had enough on their plate as well until it was made clear that these steps had to be taken, I suppose.
Brian, people are rightly preoccupied at the moment with the health side of this and making sure that we get through this outbreak. And in 2 or 3 months, people will start to focus more on the economic side and the economic damage, I think, that everybody in this country is going to have to suffer over the next while. From a rural pub's point of view, what sort of help can the government give you over the next few weeks to ensure that when we get through this, the pubs are actually in a position to reopen?
Yeah. I suppose decision making and making hard decisions would assist us greatly, you know, and it would assist every business and organisation in this country. And you listened to the interview yesterday with Dr. Michael Ryan from the World Health Organization. He's like if you get paralysed by not making decisions, you will fail. And especially he's come across all these emergencies. So if the government make decisions and let us know what to do, give us direction, I think it would be great. Personally, I feel that a pause button needs to be pressed for about 90 days, starting with the banks, and give people their grace on their kind of loan repayments, mortgage repayments. And then we go back and we look at kind of our rates, companies, talk to our suppliers. But there needs to be a 90-day pause there for everyone to survive and to get through this, you know.
Brian, if that does not happen, how under threat is your own business? How under threat are businesses in your locality?
Well, I think they're severely under pressure. Like, you know, you're talking about they'll have to be backed up maybe from family members' personal savings, going to getting restructuring loans in the banks, which is just kicking the can down the road, really. But if there's not an element of assistance, like I see. Last night they came out and announced that they're looking for employers to pay the €203 per employee that you lay off. But like employers won't have that cash flow. You know, that cash flow will run out after 2 weeks. You know, like you can't, Diageo, like we've all our stock, and Paul will be the same. They've all our stock that we were going to sell this weekend and into early this week. That still has to be paid for, even though there's no takings and that stays in stock, you know. So it's... If there's no action taken, it will lead to severe consequences, yeah?
Paul, what about in your situation then? Obviously, you've mentioned going out and potentially offering a delivery service. That's kind of a two-pronged approach. Obviously, the people in the locality are getting that service. You've also got the element of your own staff actually having some employment. I presume it has to keep you ticking over as a business as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have to try whatever you can to keep your head above water. And I suppose... those two things, as you mentioned, are kind of two main focuses for it. Is literally the employees, to try and keep them in the job and to, you know, provide a service then as well for the people that need it most around the town and the surrounding areas. But yeah, look, I suppose 2 weeks is what they're putting on it, but in all likelihood, if you look at elsewhere, if you look at China, they're just after starting to recede in numbers on Friday, I think, and that's 2 months in. So it's probably more you're looking at four weeks, or, you know, Italy's still, it's a week ahead of us and it's still in crisis there. So that's, you're talking 3 to 4 weeks at the very least. So probably the quicker that that is as well is made more clear to businesses, they can take more steps to try and sort themselves out. But you know, the cash flow is going to be under severe pressure in a lot of businesses, and as we made clear, by I think there's a lot of pubs will close and will never open again throughout the country. So you know, individually, every business is going to have to try and do what they can, and it's just going to be a very difficult time for the industry. I know everyone in the country is going to be affected by this, but you know, if you have a government job or other jobs, you still get paid. It's just it's more the industry, the tourist industry is going to take a severe hit, and you're talking about all the hotels cancellations for the next 6 months as a result of it, and all those people that were gearing up to go into school season. You know, we've taken on an extra couple of employees as well over the last while to gear up for the season, which usually kicks off around Patrick's Day. So you'd have a lot of businesses in that situation with that investment put in for the coming season. And I don't know what the government can do for it. Something will have to be done for it.
It's an unbelievably tough time, Paul, and it's almost the sort of time you would love to have football as something to take your mind off it, to go and kick a ball. Is that something you've been able to do at all? I know it doesn't seem important and it isn't important in the grand scheme of things, but are you keeping yourself fit? Are you going to be able to keep yourself ticking along over the next few weeks?
Yeah, obviously over the last couple of days it's been pretty hectic trying to get our ducks in a row, but I keep fit now over the next while and get up to the field and do some fitness work and some skills work. But it's very difficult. It's going to be very difficult when doing all that on your own again. It's kind of almost going into the off season again, because you can't train with anyone, or you can't use gyms as such. You know, so it's going to be very hard. But we could be back in 2 weeks. So you have to be ready for that. So that's the main aim now over the next while, is to keep the fitness ticking over and be ready for the season if it comes along again quickly. It's going to be a strange period. Obviously, it's the thing you want to do at the moment is take the mind off all that's going on, is go out and play football. And unfortunately, we can't do that. And people that'll be at home, we want to be putting on sports the weekend, and they don't have that either. So it's going to be a difficult time for everyone. But just get out and make sure that you're keeping your mind from being idle. I think is a strong message that's been out there, and it's important for people to do that, even if it is in isolation.
Absolutely, Paul. Final word to you then, Brian. I think you're manager of Retoth at the moment. Obviously, the clubs at the moment not going to be allowed to train either, rightly so, no collective training. Is there going to be anything, is the pitch going to be open for people to even train on their own? Is there any advice you'd have to club footballers who are at a loose end at the moment?
I suppose, like, the GAA has come down and more or less kind of closed gyms and pitches, you know, and they've kind of threatened that you wouldn't be covered in insurance, basically. I think they should be left open so that guys can go and do their own bit of work, you know. I think direction also should come, whether can you train in twos and threes, you know, because, you know, we're talking social distancing or social isolation, you know, there's a big difference, you know, and it's for, as Paul said there, it's for the mind and the body now. And that date that's thrown out there, the 29th of March, you know, it's like, that's many days away now. It's only 13 days away. So it's kind of pie in the sky. We're probably looking 4 weeks. So, look, I'd love to be able to tell lads to go out in groups of twos and threes and do their own bit and take ownership for their own body and their own mentality and do your bits of programmes. But I don't know if we're going to be allowed. It could be guys just having to get out and do bits and pieces on their own.
Yeah, and I guess home fitness regimes and things like that are going to be all the rage over the next couple of weeks as well. Listen, Brian, thanks a million for taking the call. Really appreciate it. And Paul Ganey as well. Very best luck to you over the next couple of weeks. It's going to be a tough time, but we wish you all the best. Brian Farrell, former Meath footballer, and Paul Ganey, current Kerry footballer, on the line there. Nathan is still with us. Nathan, it's obviously an unbelievably tough time for anybody in that sort of situation, and just trying to find and come up with any sort of creative way to even lessen the blow some bit is clearly paramount. And you can hear what Paul Ganey is talking about there, just trying to get a delivery service going or anything along those lines.
Well, that's, like, there's never been a situation where there's been so many layers to a crisis, and like, the social isolation is going to be a huge mental health issue for so many people, particularly down in rural parts of the country. Like, I'm up here, you know, stressing about having three children and having them locked in. There's so many people who, you know lots of them myself, who, you know, are stuck in a house by themselves for an unspecified amount of time. And anything like what Paul is talking about, is to say, it's probably not going to be a real money earner for them, but having somebody and something for somebody to look forward to, that a bit of food will be dropped at the door, is the sort of thing that at least keeps people's spirits up. Because I think for people, particularly in rural areas and real rural areas like West Kerry, it's going to be a real, real struggle over the next while.
Yeah, absolutely. We are crossing over to the UK next because Enda Stevens is on standby. But before that, let's go back to yesterday's Sunday paper review, because Cliona O'Connor reflected on this column from Wayne Rooney.
I just thought Rooney was a street footballer, 16 years old, played without a conscious thought, reactive.
And actually, from the age when he played for the Everton under 19s, when he was 14, obviously, which is just nuts. But he obviously he couldn't boss people around physically, so his coach put him at number 10, told him to get into space. And Rooney, as a 14-year-old, went off and got VHS videos of Jari Litmanen and, to a lesser extent, Dennis Bergkamp, and studied them. So, like a student of the game at 14, and hence, when Oxlade-Chamberlain doesn't know how Overmars played and came short and spun around to, you know, get in behind, he's kind of in amazement at this, really. So I don't know what you made of this, but I would agree with Tommy. This was actually surprisingly good.
Yeah, it was. And that, again, one of the things that stood out to me, well, that's the differentiator, isn't it? Because there's probably loads and loads of street footballers who had really good talent and really good ability and all of that. But how many of them went and got their VHSs and absolutely devoured the game and made themselves exceptionally knowledgeable and intelligent on a football pitch? So Rooney had physical or technical skills, and he was good enough at 14, as you were saying, to play for an under 19. So his technical skills were good enough, but he didn't rely on them. He made sure that he understood exactly what he was doing. And that, I mean, that as an attribute for any athlete in any sport, that's what you want. People talk about the growth mindset and never having enough knowledge and wanting to know more and wanting to be intelligent in your sport. That is an absolute differentiator between the child superstar that makes it and the child superstar that, oh, I had one trial for United and it didn't work out. You know, they didn't give me any game time or whatever, you know, and there's an excuse and it didn't happen. So in terms of characteristics of a successful athlete, I mean, that's a major one.
Yeah, Cian O'Connor on yesterday's Sunday paper review. You can get the full piece back on youtube.com/offtheball and available on your favourite podcast app right now as well. Right, going to the UK because Sheffield United's Enda Stevens is with us on the line. Good morning to you, Enda. How are things?
I'm good, mate. You?
Not too bad, thanks. So what is the state of play there at the moment? Is there training this morning as a Sheffield United footballer, or how are you getting on?
No, not this morning. We had a meeting on Friday, obviously, when everything was announced, and then we had the Saturday, Sunday and today off. I think we're back in training Tuesday. I think the academy and all that have been sent home, and it's literally just the first team lads, players and staff that are allowed in the building. So I think we're going to try to treat it as normal as we can for the week with training and that.
I presume that's just because of the fact that you're very much operating under the premise that football will be back at the start of April, because that is what they have said at the moment.
Yeah, we've got to aim for that. We've got a plan for that. So we don't want to have a week, 2 weeks off, and then all of a sudden it comes back on and we won't be prepared. So the manager kind of wants to keep us prepared, and we've done all the health checks. I think they've disinfected the whole building and that. We're trying to do our best to be isolated in the training ground as much as you can.
What was said in the meeting on Friday? Was the mood very calm? Was it composed? Was it a sense that things would be all right and we will be back out in the football pitch soon?
Yeah, I think so, because it was more kind of early days with it. But over the weekend, you kind of see the news breaking of more and more cases and that. It's a bit surreal, but we still have to kind of plan for that the league kicking back in April. If it does, we want to be prepared. And if it doesn't, we really don't really know what to be thinking.
Absolutely. I can completely see why you would need to be keeping on top of things, keeping on top of training, because that is the message that has been handed down. At the same time, is there any doubts in your mind at all because of the fact that other teams within Sheffield United Football Club have been told to stay at home, have been told to go home, and that you're the only lads actually going to be in the training ground?
It's hard to kind of believe all the stuff that's actually happening. We haven't actually been in the training ground yet, so I think further down the line, and especially coming up to the weekends, you'll be thinking, like, this is a bit crazy. I don't know, like, we just need to take every precaution. And as a club, they've kind of made that decision to just kind of disinfect the whole building, send as many people home as you can, and then just keep it a tight little community in the training ground.
Would you usually be training on a Monday morning? Is it already a precaution to actually push it back to tomorrow?
Sorry, could you say that again?
Would you usually be training right now? Is it already a precautionary step to not have training on a Monday morning?
Um, I, I don't know, to be honest with you. We were due to train this morning.
Okay, right.
And we just received it. We just received a text yesterday to say we'll. I think they just changed the schedule around. I think we'll go, instead of having Wednesday off, I think we'll just go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday training. So I just think they changed the schedule around rather than being a precautionary, like.
Yeah, yeah. It probably helps as well to just have an extra day to see if there is any movement, because I think if you compare the situations, and I'm sure you've been communicating quite a bit with people at home, and it is a vastly different situation in the UK and how the UK government are handling it compared to the Irish government. And like as we've already established here, Sheffield United have to operate under what they're being told, but it is different to what people are being told here when it comes to even GAA clubs and football clubs, to not train collectively, to stay at home. And that is a different message that you guys are being given in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I think, well, from what I know, I think the League of Ireland is completely shut down. Mm. I speak to my friend at Bowles, and he's been given like his GPS units and that to do his own training and to stay fit. But I don't know, like it's just, I'm not really wanting to look to delve into it. I just got to go by what my manager thinks and what the club think, and we've got our doctors on hand, and he seems to think we'll be fit and able to contain it within ourselves, within the training ground, and we've got to believe in that and back him.
Outside of Sheffield United, then, what is the mood like in the United Kingdom?
I don't really know. I've been kind of just self-isolating myself, me and my girlfriend, my little baby. So we haven't really been going outdoors, really, meeting people or meeting up with lads or anything like that. I think the first time I'll see people from the team and really outside will be tomorrow in training.
Yeah, so there hasn't been too much socialising outside of your house or anything like that. Is there any concern at all about what's happening in the likes of Chelsea with Callum Hudson-Odoi obviously testing positive, Mikel Arteta at Arsenal testing positive, that this isn't something that footballers are going to be immune from? And like you mentioned, your family and things like that, this is something that if you go into a collective training session and somebody is carrying the virus without knowing it, there are obviously wider implications for that and serious dangers for that.
Yeah, I think if anyone is to show symptoms, they're not to show up. We've had that meeting on Friday. So if there was anyone with the symptoms, or they've just got to speak to the doctor, and the doctor will say stay away for the necessary time and that. But I think a few lads have been tested, and we haven't really seemed to have that kind of one which has had the coronavirus just yet.
Mm. Would you be able to keep yourself ticking along nicely at home if you were told to stay away from the training ground over the next few weeks? Is there a good home fitness regime that you have?
Well, it's difficult for me because I'm kind of nursing a bit of an injury at the minute, so I kind of need to be in the training ground, like get me rehab and being with the physio. So that's where it kind of comes a bit difficult. But I'm pretty sure plenty of lads will be. I think plenty of lads today with the day off will probably be out going for a run themselves. But they struggle to go to public gyms because they're probably one of the worst places where you can probably get the virus and swim pools and that. So it's a difficult one, but it's one that me personally, I prefer to be in the training ground, training and that, if that is possible. If it puts us at less risk in any way possible, I'd rather be in the training ground.
And this has obviously escalated rapidly over the past few days, but we actually had your manager, Chris Wilder, on the show on Thursday, and at that stage I was asking him about whether or not he would prefer to see games played behind closed doors or whether he'd just prefer to have the season postponed. And at that stage he was talking about having the season postponed, that like football is all about the supporters. With the situation we're in now, and I don't think anybody expects supporters to be able to return, would you be happy to play games behind closed doors? One of the options that's been put out is maybe the season would be just voided completely and everyone goes back next August, the 22 team league. Like, have you any opinion on what should happen next?
I'm not too sure. The one you don't want to be playing games behind closed doors because you wouldn't miss that fan interaction and that. And obviously, everyone understands that the risks that come with it. But in terms of like avoiding the league, I think you kind of have to get to that stage. Let's see how the next 3-4 weeks is going to be. Let's see what comes of it. But I don't know. It's a hard decision to make because it's surreal for us, you know. We're just used to training during the week and then we look forward to our games and we have nothing to look forward to at the minute, like a lot of people. So I think we've just got to kind of let it get to that and just see how we get on.
Yeah, there is also probably, I'd assume, the mental health aspect of it as well and having the routine of going into training and then also the fitness that comes with it. I know obviously you're carrying a knock at the moment, but that being taken out of your life at the moment, that will provide its own sort of mental challenges over these next few weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah, it'd be tough. It'd be a bit stressful, you know, because you'd be kind of stuck at home. You're used to getting out and getting just being in an environment with a lot of good lads and good friends and that, and you kind of need that. The worst thing that could probably come of it is that you have to self-isolate for a long time and maybe be a bit torture, like, you know. But if it, as I said, if it needs to be done, it needs to be done. Obviously, this is going to get a lot worse before it gets better, and we've got to kind of do our best to contain it.
It's obviously more than likely at this point. I think it'll be an absolute shock if the playoff against Slovakia were to go ahead anytime soon. It's going to be a situation where it gets kicked down the line quite a bit. Who knows when that game is going to be played. In terms of that, is it something you've considered at all, that this opportunity to play in the Euros this summer is now going to have to be kicked back a little bit, or are you just focused on Sheffield United at the moment?
I haven't really been doing much thinking about that because obviously everything's just come at once, you know. It's trying to get your head around the Premier League being cancelled, and obviously we've been fighting for like European places and that, and everything's just been put on hold, and it's all just kind of hit you at once, and it's hard to kind of, hasn't really, well, it's sunk in, but I think over the next week and two weeks it'll really sink in, and I don't know, it's the not knowing is kind of what's killing us. I think it's killing everybody. We kind of just want to know what's the best thing to do and how quick can we get over this.
Has there been word from the Republic of Ireland management at all, just to sort of, similar to Sheffield United, stay on your toes in case this thing does go ahead, as unbelievably unlikely as that is at the moment?
No, not really, because I don't think they expect it to be going ahead.
Yeah.
We just had our meetings with Sheffield. We've had a couple of briefings even before Friday. We've had briefings throughout the week, so I'm just like obviously washing your hands and keeping as clean as you can, and that's all we kind of have. Has I think we probably be expected to have a lot more meetings now over the next week and be filled in a lot more. I don't know. I think there might be a meeting going on with the Premier League to discuss things, and we'll have to go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Enda, it's been great chatting to you. Thanks a million for taking the call, and stay safe over there. Wish you all the best.
Cheers. Thanks.
Enda Stevens there, Sheffield United fullback on the line. Yeah, it's an interesting one, Nathan. You can't really blame Sheffield United for continuing to proceed with things. It is the powers above them, obviously, where the questions need to be asked at the moment, and the powers at the very, very top of life in the United Kingdom, where serious questions have to be asked, that people are still in a will we, won't we? Will we go into collective training? Won't we go into collective training? Because that mere idea at the moment seems absurd.
Well, I think everybody is obviously putting their trust in the government that they are doing the right thing. And like Sheffield United, I would say, are no different to pretty much every Premier League club. Though I did see, I think, Liverpool sent home all their players at the end of last week with personalised training regimes, that there wouldn't be any collective training for the foreseeable future. Different clubs obviously have different attitudes, but they aren't doing anything technically wrong, according to the British government, who are saying and don't seem to have a big problem with even mass gatherings still. I know that's going to change quite quickly, it seems, this week. But as I say, all you need to do is switch on your television and you will see many, many people together in television studios, and just a totally different attitude that may well have far-reaching consequences for British society and may well have consequences for us here in Ireland as well. I think as footballers, all they're ever going to do as professionals is pretty much do what they're told and trust the advice that they've been given by their club doctors.
Yeah, that's the only thing they really can do at the moment. Like, it's interesting, this theme that is constantly going to come up, and I'd say it's going to be more pronounced almost for professional footballers over these next few months, is what do we do now? Like, as you say, they're so used to being told what to do, and that is still the case. They are still assuming that they will go into collective training in some manner or form this week as a Premier League footballer, and then that'll be perhaps taken away from them. And maybe what if the season is called off and you're in a bit of a limbo about when does the next season actually begin. Like, these are all the challenges that will come into play for professional athletes over these next few months. Obviously, there are people in far graver situations, people who will lose livelihoods and things like that, but these are still issues as well that professionals will face.
Well, I wonder, actually, are professional footballers in a far better position to deal with a crisis like this? Because I remember an article Stephen Hunt wrote a few years ago, which I think he got quite a bit of stick at from the GAA players at the time, where he spoke about what it was like to be a professional footballer, and GAA players in a way didn't know how good they had it, because part of being a professional is doing nothing. That part of being a professional footballer is getting home from training at 1 o'clock and doing nothing for the next 7 or 8 hours of resting your body, of lying on the couch, of even at times, he said, you know, if he was coming up to a big match, of not getting off the couch to go and pick the kids up from school or do the run to the shops, because his entire focus was on having his body in the best possible shape at all times. So there is a lot of time spent at home just resting the body and resting the mind. And I suspect they're a little bit more used to that side of things than the rest of us are, who probably have slightly more hectic lives. Obviously, they have that intense training session that gets them to another level of fitness that the rest of us are never going to have, that they are going to miss, and that they're going to have to try and maintain. But I think the actual spending time by yourself, and for probably the younger players, you know, spending a lot of time on PlayStation is something they're probably well used to at this stage.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. It's something like that we've seen quite a bit, that professional footballers tend to have the ability, or they have the ability to pick up, say, the bug of gaming quite a bit. It's something actually that I'd be interested to hear David Myler's thoughts on, actually, that even during the tail end of his professional career, to have this other interest just completely explode off the pitch while he was going to training in the middle of the day, just because you've got so much free time that we could probably learn a thing or two from them about how they actually deal with that, how they kind of park that cabin fever early on, because I'm sure it is a challenge for people who go into a professional environment at, say, a later age than the academy setups, because they've got to get used to all of this sort of thing.
Well, most footballers, I'd imagine, go for a nice little nap every afternoon as well, which is the right thing to do and the recommended thing to do. We'd all love to do that now for the next few weeks and get our mind off things. So I do think, yeah, it's the players, and like everybody who doesn't have an interest that somehow you can maintain over the next while, that it's going to be a bit of a struggle. And if you're into gaming, and I was semi-joking about getting a PlayStation, semi-joking, I used to be a football manager addict, like I'm sure many of our viewers have been down through the years. And at various stages, particularly when I first met my wife, I got her to break my Football Manager CD, as it was at the time,
right,
just to stop me from playing it, because I was like, it was just insane. Listen, anybody who plays Football Manager knows how addictive it is. But part of me actually thinks maybe the best thing for my mental health right now is to get back into Football Manager.
No,
because you can get so into it. You can get so into it that actually it just takes your mind off absolutely everything else. Suddenly, I'm not stressing and worrying about the real world. I'm wondering, is Cherno Samba going to be fit? And whether you see, of course, obviously you're only going to play Championship Manager 01 or 02. The new one, from what I've seen, is just far, far too complicated. Like, you have to do training sessions. No, I want to pick Julius Agahoa, Cherno Samba up front, 17 and 19, and let them bloom over the next decade. And suddenly, if I'm stressing about that, I'm not stressing about the real world. And maybe that's a good thing.
So what was this? This was some sort of ceremony where you were like, listen, I'm now going to dedicate my life to something other than Football Manager. You can come and smash this CD.
Yes. And then I think I decided about a month later I'd get it again. I'd be more restrained. But I didn't have that power, unfortunately, to do that. So again, the disc went in the bin. But I'm fairly sure you can download Championship Manager 0102 just straight onto your laptop now.
Really? I thought you could only do that for new. Oh, no. See, this is the thing.
Yes.
I never did get onto the Championship Manager buzz that early. That early. Like, I'm very much about 2012, I think, was probably my peak Football Manager. So I didn't actually get onto the Cherno Samba, Freddie Adu sort of glory years that everybody raves about. But you'd obviously recommend it.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you go in and whatever club you're managing. I think Cherno Samba plays for Millwall when he's still 16. And you go in day one, you sign him, you're probably going to have to pay a good chunk of money. And the frustration with him is, you know, while he's unbelievably talented for a 16-year-old, as all 16-year-olds are, you know, they're frustrating and inconsistent. So you do have to wait 2 or 3 years. And the worry is that you get fired from your current club that you bought him for. And then he's stuck there, you're gone, and he goes on to become the greatest player in the world. And you're stuck managing Leicester City, who back in Championship Manager 0102 is not a good place to be.
Just got a YouTube comment in here from Christian Pierce saying Championship Manager 0102 is free to play.
Exactly. So yeah, so all you need to do now is download it. So there you go.
Community made transfer updates also. So transfer updates, does that mean to the end of the season?
Does that mean they have the current players?
That would be sensational if that was the case, because that's what you want. You want a sort of dumbed down version of it that you can actually get in, play a decade of Football Manager in the space of a month.
Mm.
Whereas in the current guys, doing a season of Football Manager in a month would be a big thing. But I think they've actually got in the new one. I may have actually done a bit of research in this over the course of the weekend. Apparently, the new Football Manager, they have started to scale it back a bit because they have realised that this is just outrageous. Like, this is the level of detail you can possibly have.
We never got into your opening comment about that you had downloaded Fortnite.
Yeah.
Is Fortnite not for children?
I'm a child, Nathan. Fortnite is for everybody, really. There, you can't. No person too young, too old can play. I think it's just the same as any other athletic endeavor, Nathan. The older you get, the slower you get, and the slower your reaction times are get. That's why kids are better at it than adults. But I still fancy myself as a bit of a trigger finger and could possibly thrive in the Fortnite environment. But I didn't do it. I got 15% and then clicked cancel on that because.
Good.
That would be automatic self-isolation. You wouldn't even need to self-isolate yourself if you're playing Fortnite at my age.
Well, Football Manager is a far more mature choice, I think it's fair to say.
I think so too. We must look into that. Championship Manager 0102, free to play. Make sure to comment on the YouTube stream below if you've got any more Championship Manager updates for Nathan and I, or you can tweet us as well at Off the Ball. Right, we're going to have the sports news with Tom very shortly, but before that, during yesterday's Sunday pay-per-view, the realities of working from home dawned on one Tommy Martin.
Lingering memories, probably far more so than Liverpool, Atletico, the scenes at Cheltenham last week. Now, who knows? The months ahead, I'm sure, will provide us with far more vivid memories, unfortunately. But it was a really bad week for that sport in particular.
Yeah. Just have an intrusion here. I can see you.
if Tommy Martin's wife is listening to the radio, could she rescue Tommy? His daughter has made an appearance to the nation.
Thank you.
Oh, dear. I saw a tweet, Tommy. You know, remember when we first started doing Skype in the World on Media and the BBC News guy and his daughter walks in? I saw during the week someone had retweeted that picture and said, "This is all of us now. And Tommy Martin, this is you."
Exactly. In fairness, my wife, she did bring them away for a walk for an hour.
How long does it take to review the papers? We're home, for God's sake.
God, get on with it.
Yeah, now is your time, children of Ireland, if your parents happen to be sports broadcasters that are on Off the Ball. Now is the time to make your name, your time to shine. Tom Malone, good morning. What's the crack?
Hi, Owen. How are you? I'm hoping Shane Hannan or Amory Donlan don't do the same and ruin my live news broadcast here in the office. Children just can't be trusted.
We are practicing very sensible social distancing. You are about 20 metres away, but we're in the same office. You can't be bothered coming into the studio, basically, is what the story is, Tom.
Yeah, essentially, Tommy's laid down the very sensible rules, so we're all gonna obey them.
How has isolation been for you?
It's been pretty strange. I'm in the office today on my own, pretty much this bulletin echoing.
Distancing, not isolation, just to be clear.
Pardon?
This distancing is what I meant to say, not isolation. You don't need to isolate just yet.
No, thankfully I don't. No, the social distancing is going okay. It suits me anyway. It suits my personality. I don't really like people.
Yeah, you hate people. You've always made that clear, Tom. You're addicted to everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Who comes to you.
Right, will we start with a little bit of good news?
Yeah, let's do it.
Right, Manchester United's Paul Pogba has pledged some financial support to help the coronavirus pandemic. The France midfielder has set up a fundraising page on Facebook and says he will double the amount raised if the £27,000 target is reached. Well, that's kind of where the good news ends, unfortunately, Owen. Former Manchester City defender Elokim Mangala, meanwhile, is one of five Valencia players and staff to test positive for COVID-19. Argentina international Ezequiel Garay is another. Mangala has said, though, that he is self-isolating and the club say all of the individuals are in good health currently. We move on to boxing, and Emmett Brennan will face a Swiss opponent in the last 16 of the Olympic qualifiers in London. The Dublin Docklands boxing clubman needs a top six finish to qualify for Tokyo. He's back in action tomorrow at St. Patrick's Day against Switzerland's Uke Smalley, who was joined in the last 16 by Talon lightweight George Bates and Dublin heavyweight Kirill Afanasyeval. Today in London, Aidan Walsh and Michael Nevin are fighting for places in the last 16, with all bouts behind closed doors from now on. one. Brendan Irvine, Carly McNull and Kurt Walker are vying for places in the last eight of qualifying. And we'll stick with boxing, and it's been widely reported that the British boxing world champion Tyson Fury could face a new investigation from UK anti-doping. A failed drugs test in 2015 was blamed on eating uncastrated wild boar. But a Mail on Sunday has reported that allegations from a farmer who claimed he was offered money to provide a false alibi for Fury. He never received the money, though. However, promoter Frank Moran, who wasn't involved with the boxer at the time, has dismissed that story as rubbish. Full impact on the coronavirus is having on sport could be clearer by the end of the week, with 5 months to go until Tokyo 2020 and several qualifying events postponed. The International Olympic Committee will hold talks with the head of global sport governing bodies tomorrow. There will also be a UEFA video conference where the postponement of Euro 2020 and how to reschedule the Champions League and Europa League will be on the agenda. Meetings of the British domestic leagues will follow later on the week to discuss the longer term plan. Of course, competitions there are currently shut down. Today, Rugby Union's Premiership and also the Super League, Rugby League Super League, are expected to be the next sports postponed. While a meeting is set to take place today is the best way forward on how the Six Nations, of course, that's already postponed. That's been Halloween mooted there. Horse racing in the UK looks like it's finally going to move behind closed doors this week. Only Kelso will do so today. That's voluntarily. While Hereford and Southall, there's racing there, but they will actually continue as normal. Bizarrely, of course, racing in Ireland has been behind closed doors since Friday morning on.
Good stuff, Tom. That's incredible, really, that racing goes ahead at some parts of the UK yet again today. Right, just before we wrap up the sports news today, have a look at this. This is a message from Jack McCaffrey, who is urging communities around Ireland to do their bit.
Hi, guys. Jack McCaffrey here, just doing a very quick video. Still getting used to seeing my own clean-shaven face. It's the first time in a long time I've been like that. And the reason for that is because it helps those of us who work in hospitals protect ourselves and protect other patients while we're dealing with people who have the new COVID-19 disease. And the reason for this video is that I'm just looking to ask that everybody else continue to do their bit to help out with that as well. Whether that be washing our hands coming in and out of the house, whether that be avoiding public gatherings. I just want to thank everybody who's been helping so far and re-emphasize how important they are. So please, please, please do continue to follow those instructions, and thank you very much.
Yeah, great stuff from Jack McCaffrey there, sending out a fairly worthwhile message. We're going to get to Classic Game Club soon. This morning, it's going to be the 1990 All-Ireland Football Final between Meath and Cork. A fantastic year for Cork GAA, doing their first double in 100 years that year. So they did it in 1890, they did it in 1990 as well, winning the hurling and the football. It's going to be Tommy and Nathan with me. They've been watching the game back over the course of the weekend. But of secondary importance, as well as at hand at the moment, and before we get into Classic Game Club, Brian O'Driscoll reflected on the integral role sport plays in our lives.
It always seems a little bit weird when events of such global magnitude are happening to be talking about sport. And at the same time, you know, in a couple of weeks' time, when the full absence of sport from our lives begins to have an impact, we will begin to realise just how much we miss it and how important it is as something that is a social glue, and also just a way for us to talk about things and to be distracted from the news cycle.
100%, and we take it for granted. We just you look at the amount of sport that's being cancelled. Well, we're not even aware of how many events and how much is going on, be it at a professional level, be it at an amateur level. You know, when you look at, you know, kids underage being cancelled, training sessions being cancelled, sport is an integral part of our existence. Certainly in Ireland and part of my existence, you know, Saturday morning going down to, you know, my kids' football and gymnastics, all of those parts are just the makeup of your week, and they're a staple, and it's something that you look forward to. And only when it's taken away from you do you realize what an important component it is to your existence. So, yeah, from our perspective and from everybody's perspective, I hope this process doesn't go on longer than we anticipate it might, because it really is it's a key component plugged into people's everyday or weekly living, where they get refuge from work or from family or from whatever issues they might have, and they're able to vent through their sporting team, through playing themselves, through going to the gym, and it's such a vital part of society. So it's tricky and strange and weird times.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Off the ball. Oh, wow. This is...
I'm washed off the ball. I'm Scottish. I'm Scottish. Oh,
you met a South African last night and he was there. He knew that Dublin won 5 in a row because he watched us off the ball.
Oh.
He really... And he listened to Thailand.
I've watched off the ball on YouTube. The good boys.
We love it. We love you. We love you. And everywhere we follow. We follow.
We absolutely love it.
Off the ball. This is OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station. OTB AM.
And a 13 metres penalty for about the fourth time in this match. This is it then for me. This is it for Cork as well, however. Slocum outside towards John O'Driscoll. It's going to be a free. Time almost up. They live on the edge of their seats. Cork, beaten by Meath in 1967. Beaten by Meath in 1987. Beaten after a replay in 1988. Are the 14 men to prevail in front of their loyal band of fans. The subs wait. The double has been achieved. It's Cork's All-Ireland. It's Cork's year. The double in hurling. Double in football. In 1890 it was two club sides, but now a county selection has achieved this remarkable feat. Cork's first victory in the All-Ireland over Meath, and the county's sixth victory in all. The day and the month of September belongs to the red and white. The Sam Maguire has been retained by the champions.
Yeah, the year, of course, is 1990, and those are the sounds from the All-Ireland football final between Meath and Cork. Cork doing the double. They, of course, had won the hurling a few weeks previous. It is our focus this morning for the Classic Game Club. This is the show where we go back and watch old matches. It's like a book club, except for classic games. This week, Tommy Rooney and Nathan Murphy have been watching back that classic between Meath and Cork. Nathan, as the resident spokesperson for the 1990s here, to put it that way. Do you remember this game at all?
No, I was thinking you two lads, I presume, weren't even born.
No.
When this happened. Watching it back last night, it's like watching a different sport. Part of me was watching it going, this is the worst game of Gaelic football I have ever seen. And then I'm just trying to recalibrate my head that actually it just doesn't feel like the Gaelic football that we watch now in any way. Mm. The brilliance of it is the toughness of it, and obviously the rivalry of Cork and Meath, and Cork going for that first ever double, and the sheer strength of some of the men on the pitch. But it's like, I don't remember once during the game a halfback getting the ball and making a rampaging run forward. Every time a halfback got the ball, it was, I'm going to kick this as far forward as I possibly can. Like, this is a final that took place, what, 2 months after Italia 90?
Yeah.
And it's Jack Charlton style football. It's get it forward as quickly as you possibly can.
Paul McGrath and Mick McCarthy on the pitch, of course, for Cork as well. The Italian 90s references can go on and on. I noticed that as well. It's just, there's a lot of hoofing going on in this game. It is the most manly man's game, potentially, in the history of Gaelic football. I think it's probably peak manliness, peak tough guy. The couple of things that I noticed, first of all, everybody in this game looks like they are 38 years old. They all look really unbelievably old. There is a time when the camera pans to Stephen O'Brien, and I'm like, this guy is clearly a grizzled veteran. He clearly has about 10 kids. And then the commentator is like, Stephen O'Brien, of course, under 21 next year again. And I'm like, how do all these kids look like they're 40 years old? They all look like they've been through the wars. They've seen some things that none of us should see. They're all well beyond their years. Everybody is a tough guy, and you do not want to get caught in the crossfire of Meath versus Cork in 1990.
That's what living through the 80s does to you, I guess.
It's true. Tough time.
There's many, Conor Cunahan's hair is a revelation.
Mm.
throughout the game. Yeah, they do all, like, the very fact Mick Lyons is on the pitch just gives it an extra a level of manliness.
Oh, without question. We'll get into Mick Lyons in a moment, because he takes a haymaker and just brushes it off as if it's nothing. Just to give the context for this game, like, as you mentioned there, and it was mentioned in the commentary there as well, a more than familiar rivalry at this point, late 80s into the early 90s, Meath versus Cork. So they'd met in the 1987 final, Meath had won that game. Met in the 1988 final, Meath had won that game. At this point, Cork had never actually beaten Meath in the All-Ireland Football Championship, but they had beaten Mayo to win the 1989 All-Ireland final. So they're going for a double-double of sorts, because as we've mentioned, they've beaten Galway in the hurling a few weeks previous and were All-Ireland football champions. And to make it sweeter, they now have a crack at Meath to get revenge for 87 and 88 in the 1990 decider. So this is 100 years on since their only other double. So there's a kind of a nice symmetry to that, 80-90 the last time they did it. I was looking into this as to whether or not Cork are the only county to ever do the double. They're not. Can you guess, Nathan, the other county to have done it?
I'm going to say Tipperary.
Oh, great shout. Yeah, correct. Got it in one. Tipperary, your 19th century GA knowledge knows no bounds.
Just don't ask me to name the year. 1923.
I think it's something around then. I didn't even jot that down here. Just to go through the teams in the day, and just to clarify, each and every one of these is a hard bastard, I think it's fair to say. So the Cork team, you have John Kerrins in goal, you have a full back line of Tony Nation, Niall Cahalan, the beast that is Niall Cahalan, and Stephen O'Brien as a full back line. Michael Slocum, Conor Coonahan and Barry Coffey as their halfbacks, while Shea Fahey and Danny Cullity, like a hard-hitting midfield there. They're 8-9 for Cork on the day. Dave Barry, Captain Larry Tompkins and Teddy McCarthy is the half-forward line. Teddy McCarthy, of course, the only man to have started the hurling, who's also involved in this football team. Paul McGrath and Mick McCarthy, as I've already mentioned, either side of Cullum O'Neill in the full forward line. Meath then, their goalkeeper was Donal Smith. They have a full back line of Robbie O'Malley, Mick Lyons and Terry Ferguson. A half back line of Brendan Riley, Kevin Foley and Martin O'Connell. Liam Hayes and Jerry McEntee in midfield. Like, that is the battle to end all battles. Shea Fahey and Danny Cullity against Liam Hayes and Jerry McEntee. Fantastic lineup of midfielders there. You had a half forward line then of David Beggy, PJ Gillick and Colin Brady. And then a star-studded full forward line for Meath. Captain Cullum O'Rourke, Brian Stafford a full forward, and Bernard Flynn a corner forward. Like, you look at those two teams, Nathan, and I think if you're kind of comparing icons versus icons, that Meath team definitely edges it in terms of more high-profile names.
Yeah, well, that Meath full forward line is as good as it gets, and maybe actually the entire game hung on the fact that Cullum O'Rourke wasn't fully fit for the match. But yeah, it's just tough, tough men, every single one of them. Like the context, looking at the game, actually, one of the first things that stood out was how cold it seemed to be.
How cold?
Jerry McEntee looked absolutely frozen at the throw-in.
I did not notice.
He looked like he was shivering.
Maybe he was just scared.
maybe he knew the battle was to come. I did like the fact, actually, from a purely media,
if you knew Jerry McEntee, lads, you'd know that Jerry McEntee wasn't scared.
Tommy Rooney, how are you doing? Come on in.
Hiya, fellas. How are you?
We were just saying here that this Meath team on paper, far more star-studded than Cork, and it's an absolute disgrace that he didn't win this All-Ireland.
A disgrace that it didn't win this All-Ireland. I have a good point to make on that when we get back to the sliding doors moment a little later on the Classic Game Club. Was it a disgrace? Look, if you look at the age profile, there was a good split in that Meath team. There's a lot of 20-year-olds, but there's a lot of lads that were quite old as well. I don't know. Do you know what? It was a disgrace. The shooting on show that day was probably a disgrace. Brian Stafford is one of the best footballers in the country. And watching it back last night, I couldn't believe the amount of frees he missed in the second half. Some of the bad decisions that were made. Nathan mentioned that Colin O'Rourke wasn't fit. Like, I think that's the only reason Cork snuck this one by a couple of points.
Yeah, and that is it. They did sneak this. It's a terrible game, Tommy.
Terrible, but like...
But terrible is too strong, first of all. That's definitely hyperbole. Is it indicative of the sport at the time, or is this a bad game, even taking into the context of the early 90s?
I think it's a bit of both. When we said we were going to do this game, now... A classic can be a classic for a number of reasons. It's not a classic because there's loads of goals. It's not a classic because, you know, of the history around it as well. A classic can be a classic for any amount of reasons. And this one is a classic because you mentioned earlier on the hardiness on show. This was a time when men were men. Nowadays,
what does that phrase mean?
Footballers, footballers are footballers nowadays, and men were men back then. Those lads weren't really playing football a lot of the time. The amount of hoofs up the pitch. And I think, I know actually an intercounty coach who has recently done a case study on Dublin Mead in 1991. He went back and he watched all four games. And I'm going to try and get it on paper and bring it to air, the learnings that he found from that Dublin Mead saga and how the quality just wasn't there. Like, so, like, when you're looking at some players on show, like, clearly, like, when Colin O'Neill broke through and smashed the ball off that crossbar, there isn't many footballers nowadays that do that. But, like, Brian Stafford's first point in that game, he strokes over loved ball up the outside of his point. There wasn't really much kicking like that. Bernard Flynn is a stylish footballer. But apart from that, there were boots, just big old hoofs. Couldn't be wearing Doc Martens to put them over the bar.
I disagree with you fundamentally on the lack
of
stylish footballers. I think that this was indicative of the way footballers were instructed to play at that time. Like, you mentioned Conor Coonan's stylish hair, Nathan, but look at the style of the footballer. Like, the utter grace that man carried, Liam Hayes, the grace that he carried, just, like, floating above the turf.
Oh, and just a good example on Coonan there. There's a great moment in the second half towards the end where he sells two brilliant dummies, and then he fists the ball away. But that just doesn't happen nowadays. Like, yeah, you might say Gaelic football is robotic now, but that was a 10-yard hand pass, and it just goes completely astray. I don't know whether the quality, maybe it was cold, as Nathan said, looking back in photos.
I thought you said men were men, Tommy.
What?
I thought you said men were men. The cold shouldn't be affecting how these men play the game, if you were saying that this was an incredibly masculine time for Gaelic football.
Well, it was, do you not think it was a masculine time? The hits that went on in that game were absolutely outrageous.
They were, and they were fair. One question I want to ask before we get into some of the categories here. Who would you run through a brick wall for first? Billy Morgan or Sean Boylan?
Sean Boylan. That suit he wore was unbelievable as well. Talk about style.
Yeah, Boylan. Boylan every day of the week.
Sean Boylan looks like he's Jordan Belfort about to get onto his yacht in the Wolf of Wall Street. Like, he absolutely... God, he's got that style down, the shirt and the slacks. Billy Morgan, though, and the tracksuit, there's something a bit more terrifying about that. Like, I do love the sight of the two men sort of talking to their teams before throw-in, as if this is some sort of very calm, composed speech. And I'm sure what they're saying is said in a very calm and composed speech. But what they're clearly saying to their team is, you need to go out there and absolutely murder your opponent. And that is that is Sean Boylan in a nutshell there, you know. An unbelievably nice man, and then his team would be sent out there to kill their opponent. But actually, does that really happen throughout this, except for the very obvious punch that happens? Was this not quite a clean game?
What about all the slide tackles? Like, what happened to that tackling technique that seemed to be prevalent back then, where you led with the feet first? That happened time and time again.
I think it felt like a clean game because players, very much in contrast to now, took their punishment of a free. It was very, very rare that a player complained. Like, there was a respect for referees, it seemed, back then. Constantly in the first 10 minutes was free after free after free. But it just happened quickly. The player who gave away the free acknowledged he'd hit his man late. Move on. Whereas now, every single free is a surrounding the referee, and it feels like it's a dirtier game.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. We may take that point and go straight into moment of the match here. So for anybody who's just joining us in the Classic Game Club, we've got a load of different categories that we go through throughout the duration of the podcast. Moment of the match is where we tend to start. And I'm going to lead this off by mentioning Colm O'Neill boxing the head off Mick Lyons. And boxing the head off Mick Lyons doesn't do Mick Lyons justice here, because what happens is Colm O'Neill is done, what is it, for picking the ball off the ground? It's some innocuous foul.
Lyons comes through the back of him, like Lyons fouls him. Like.
Yeah, and but like it's a free out, it's a bad call by the referee, who is Paddy Russell, by the way. Like, Meath people must love Paddy Russell.
Do not love Paddy Russell. A couple of people texted me last night saying Paddy Russell ruined them in that game. Now, I wasn't sure looking back if that was the case, but Mead fans who'd watched it back in the 90s were telling me Paddy Russell ruined them about that day.
Paddy Russell is the man who advised Pat McNenny to send Lee McHale off. Let's not forget. Mead people must absolutely love
this referee. We're talking about 1990 here. We're not talking about 1996.
It's all the one decade. Anyway, back to Colm O'Neill. So Colm O'Neill gets a straight red card. after picking the ball off the ground, he's a little bit annoyed. So he just goes in with the inside of the fist straight to the head of Mick Lyons, who barely flinches and is like, all right, I just got boxed in the head with a left hook there by a fairly big man. Carries on with his business. As you say, people are actually just able to get on with it. And Colm O'Neill gets a red card. For me, that is the summation of this game. The level of hardness you needed to have within you to even get an entry pass into one of these teams at the time.
Yeah, I think that was my moment of the match as well. Because when you look at it first, it looks as though, from the initial camera angle, as though Colm O'Neill almost just flicks at him. But then you see a couple more angles and he gives him a good thump.
It's a dunt. It's just a dunt, lads. That's a dunt.
He just kind of brushes it off. Yeah. Mick Lyons is probably as shocked as anybody else that Colm O'Neill was sent off.
No, he was worried not, for his lads, own future. No, Mick Lyons was not shocked that Colm O'Neill punched dunt, give him a dunt in the face. If you watch it back frame by frame, the free gets given. Okay. O'Neill doesn't whinge to the referee, but he kind of holds on to the ball. If you pause it there, Mick Lyons has the tongue out. He looks like that emoji who's about to pull a fast one. And he goes in and he gives O'Neill a bit of a dunt to the shoulder and he knows he's going to get a reaction. He gets punched in the face and he's delighted. There's nothing better than getting punched in the face back then. Red card. Can I just mention my moment of the match? And it happened about three frames after that. It's the walk from Mick Lyons after that. As he's walking away and that iconic number 3 jersey just shining in gold and his collar. How his collar is just ruffled the way it is. Honestly, I couldn't make my mind up last night. Should he be replacing Pierce Brosnan as James Bond or should he be a Bond villain? He was one or the other. That's my moment of the match.
James Bond for me, definitely. Definitely more of a Bond man. This is mentioned by Charlie Mulgrew in the aftermath of the game. Charlie Mulgrew there with his notebook on the Sunday game is a unique side. But he's talking about that as well, that this is all a Mick Lyons master plan to get Colm O'Neill sent off. I think we're giving him too much credit there, Tommy.
No, you're not. You're talking about the greatest fullback that has existed, apart from Darren Fay.
He may. I love this Meade bias. He may have the best jaw of any footballer of the 90s, but I'm not giving him credit for actually wanting to wind Colm O'Neill up so that he would test his own jaw.
100%. 100%. That's what he's doing. Like, are you thinking O'Neill's just going to take it like a man, because men were men back then, and he didn't take it like a man.
If you wanted to go for a different moment in this match, the John Kerrin save in the second half would have to be up there. In terms of an important moment of actual football that occurred, I can't even remember who gets the shot away, Tommy. I can't remember.
Colm O'Rourke. I think it's Colm O'Rourke.
Is it O'Rourke who gets the shot away in the end? Or is Beggy, no? But anyway,
it's one of the full forward line. It's either O'Rourke or Stafford who gets the shot away.
But it comes from this unbelievable run from Liam Hayes, and this is like 40 minutes into the game. We haven't seen anything from Hayes. He's getting castigated at halftime in the analysis. Like, we've seen loads of McEntee, we've seen loads of the two Cork midfielders, and then the fourth midfielder on the pitch, Liam Hayes, has been anonymous. And then all of a sudden he decides, right, I'm going to show you all why I'm so highly rated. Just slaloms through about 20 Cork players and sets up the opportunity for Beggy, who should bury it. And at that point, that's back at the net, 15 men against 14, Meath win the All-Ireland. But John Kerrin pulls off this unbelievable save, which apparently, now I haven't watched the 1990 hurling final back, is similar to a Ger Cullingham save that is made in the hurling final. And these two moments are very symmetrical, that there is these two Cork goalkeepers winning the double for the county. For me, in terms of the competitive direction of the game, John Kerrin doesn't make that save. Meade scored that goal. Cork do not win the double in 1990.
It was a key moment. It was a massive moment. And it was actually, the three-man weave is a drill that every club footballer in the country can now take a break from for the next however long we're out of this. But it was a perfect three-man weave as well, because Kevin Foley was going off his left shoulder and he was open. So he could have slipped it to Foley inside. And of course, Foley's the man who puts the ball in the back of the net against Dublin the following year. So maybe that's history there, a sliding doors moment there, slip it to your left and it's in the back of the net, and that's the All-Ireland for Meade in 1990.
Potentially you might be onto something there. Let's talk about the halftime show. Nathan, what are your takeaways from this?
Oh, sorry, this is the moment of the match.
I think it probably is.
The entire halftime was, I was, when I was watching it back, about to start flicking through, and I thought there was something wrong with the YouTube page as I kept flicking past this Cadbury's ad. That even though I was fast-forwarding, was still on. The Cadbury's ad, this must have been Super Bowl levels of expenditure from Cadbury's in 1990. The ad must go on for 3 minutes.
It has to
and
be.
And nothing happens during it.
It's just slow, sensual.
It's salivating. I wanted a Dairy Milk more than I ever wanted one in my life last night. It's unbelievable.
It's an erotic chocolate ad.
In the middle of an All Ireland final that goes on for a good 2 minutes.
Like, this is the 1990s, guys. This is like, we're a very kind of conservative country at this point. This is not suitable for young eyes, this Cadbury's ad, and how long it goes on for. There's a lot of people who've seen things they've never seen before when they see that Cadbury's ad at halftime.
There was a hell of a lot of dairy in that ad break as well.
A lot of dairy, a lot of milk.
That was quite enjoyable. And then there's an ad for Flora. I don't know whether we can call it butter or we call it spread. I don't know what it is.
Spread.
What else happens in the halftime show, Nathan?
Well, very little analysis, for starters. So Martin Carney's there, obviously, as chief analyst, I presume, at that stage. Who was alongside him again?
Charlie Mulgrew.
Charlie Mulgrew's there, and Charlie Mulgrew literally looks like he was walking past the studio and they decided to, Charlie, come in here for 5 minutes. We hear very little from either of them, because we're sitting watching Declan Nerney for a good 7 or 8 minutes. I presumed when they came back that they would show the first 30 seconds and then they might have the music in the background. But no, we got the full Declan Nerney experience and he was loving it.
You can forget J-Lo as far as I'm concerned. Forget Shakira. It is all about Declan Ernie if you want a good halftime show. They pulled out all the stops for him. They have the current Artane Boys band, the 1991, and then the past Artane Boys band as well. They brought out two different Artane bands to satisfy the musical needs of Declan Ernie at this point. It is big show band stuff in the middle of Croke Park, and he is wearing the most outrageous outfit you will ever see. All the colours of the rainbow on his tie. I don't know, it looks like Sergeant Pepper or something in the middle of the Croke Park pitch. Why don't we have this anymore? Why has the halftime pageantry been taken away from the GAA?
No, I think maybe not the last couple of years, but they did have bands come on at halftime and play an old song.
But like, that's because you've been in Croke Park for All Ireland Finals recently, Nathan. People on TV don't get to see that.
Oof.
That's true. RT should be broadcasting it. For me, this is the start of something great, where it's like Declan Ernie and this big band and everybody waving their flags at halftime for the GAA to turn around and say, how can we do this again? How can we go bigger and better over these next few years? Not that you can get any bigger and better than Declan Ernie, that is.
That's the thing, though. Like, the GAA, 30 years ago, the GAA was potentially more futuristic than it is today. Like, what's the first thing Jerry Canning says in that YouTube commentary? Welcome to our British viewers on Channel 4. I didn't realise that. I didn't know that the All-Ireland Final was broadcast on Channel 4 back in the day. Is that... Did everyone know that? Did you know that?
No.
No, I didn't. And yeah, like, that's something that stuck out to me as well. This seems something that is so perfectly of its time. If you told me, draw a sketch of the 1990 All-Ireland Football Final, I would probably draw exactly that. It is perfect in terms of the flags, in terms of the colours, in terms of the specific advertising that has been done around the stadium. It is just so perfectly 1990 and of its time. But you're right, there is like a GAA kind of leaning towards a more futuristic element. There is kind of inklings of a new Ireland. I know afterwards you have Larry Tompkins giving a shout out to everybody from San Francisco to London, that there is still a huge diaspora of Irish people. Emigration is still a thing. And there are Cork people all over the world watching this thing, that there is Ireland at a crossroads here, getting used to erotic chocolate ads at halftime, big musical acts at halftime of a game, and uber commercialism in certain areas as well. It's an interesting snapshot of Irish life.
There was also a moment before halftime, I don't know whether you could pick it up in the commentary, and I'm not going to say the word, but we all know the chant that was directed towards the referee, and I presume it was the Cork fans, because Colin O'Neill had just been sent off.
Well, you could also
hear the referees...
Yeah, the referee's a wanker. You could hear the Cork accent through the chant. It was like Cork people singing in unison. The Cork
go on, give it a go.
Well, you know, I wouldn't. It's what is it? 9:14 in the morning. It's grand. So I can't really do a Cork accent. The referee's a wanker. But I can't do a Cork accent. I can't say a Cork accent. I can't sing a Cork accent. But that was what
Jesus,
we heard.
Everyone's self-isolated at home this morning. Nobody in the state.
You've never had more people watching you, and that's what you have to come up with.
You know, I'm pretty proud of that.
Well, hey, what about the size of the men back then? They were huge. Joe Castle's come on the field for Jerry McEntee to start the second half, and I've never seen a man so big.
He is gigantic. I was like, who the hell is this man? Like, he is...
But even we're constantly putting up the weights of the players every time.
Yes.
I was like, Colin
that made
O'Neill
me feel
like,
better about myself.
6'2", 14 stone 7.
Yeah.
Yeah, welcome.
I was like, bloody hell, I could have made it back then.
And Jerry McEntee is 6'2", 12 stone. Like, there is varying degrees of weights amongst people of similar heights here. There's also like a big fella that comes on for Cork with a big knee brace. And I'm pretty sure there's nothing wrong with his knee. He's just trying to take the piss out of Colm O'Rourke by wearing a knee brace. Like there's tons of things that come. Like your man Castles who comes on, it's like one of those kids Disney movies where two kids stand on top of each other and put a big overcoat on it. I was fully sure there was two human beings inside the Cork jersey at that point, or inside the Meath jersey at that point. Right, let's move on to secret man of the match. The actual man of the match was Shea Fahey.
Damn it.
Yeah, you've probably gone for him.
Yeah.
I had to do a bit of looking into this. But Fahey, I think, is the man who actually did get given man of the match that night on the Sunday game. I'm going to just kick this off, and I'm going to nominate Larry Tompkins because of the fact that one thing has never changed in Gaelic football, and that is the free taker, when it comes to it in the business end of Gaelic football, will be your most important man on the pitch. And Larry Tompkins, in my view, is the most important man on the pitch on this occasion, just because of some of his unerring ability to put the ball over the bar at certain times, escaping the attention of multiple people time and time again, and kicked 2 points after doing his cruciate in this game. So he said this a few years later: "My knee took a wobble and my cruciate severed, but I hopped up quick, afraid Dr. Conn would come in and take me off. It was like someone had shot you. The pain was unreal. But then it went and I just blanked it out of my head. If I was going to die, I was going to die there." He did his cruciate. He kicked 2 points. There is no way he is not the man of the match, in my eyes, in this game, Larry Tompkins.
Yeah, I think you can go along with that, particularly considering in the first half how poor the score-taking was. There was a surprise. Larry Tompkins didn't take the first free, but they give it to Colm O'Neill and put it wide, and he looked absolutely deflated. It was a bad old day for Colm O'Neill. He hit the crossbar as well in the first half. It just didn't happen for him. But yeah, Tompkins, in such a tight game, in such a terrible game of football, your free taker is always going to be absolutely crucial. And yeah, it's hard to disagree.
For me, lads, Dave Barry was my secret man of the match. He went about his business quietly, but he was absolutely everywhere. I didn't realise that. I thought Sean Boynton maybe brought it in a couple of years later, the wing forwards that would drop deep and be everywhere. But he played a role like Brian Duher or Paul Galvin would have played in the 2000s. He was absolutely exceptional. And I actually enjoyed following him, kind of bouncing off shoulders the way you would in, like, what's the name of the bumper cars? Like, that's what the shoulders are like back then. You'd bump off one man onto another. And Dave Barry was just doing that the whole time. So he was my secret man of the match.
The tackling was good, can we say that? I thought there were some good interceptions. Like, I see your eyebrows are raised, Tommy, about this. I thought it was quality, like, as you say, like bumper cars, good clean shoulders quite a bit.
I have written down here 6 tackles that would be banned in rugby in 2020.
go through them. Do you have the 6 tackles, or what were they like?
Was like a shoulder to the head, there was clotheslines, there was just lads getting nailed left, right and centre, and they just got up and got on with it. I really did enjoy the bumper car element of the shoulders, though. There's one moment, I think I put it up on Twitter accidentally, a 3-second video of a Meath man fielding a ball between 3 Cork lads and just bouncing between all 3 of them. Like, it was comical, but it was brilliant.
Paul McGrath, Danny Cullity need a shout out for man of the match here as well. I thought they were excellent. You're not giving Tony McEntee any love here, Tommy? Was he not one of the best players?
Jerry McEntee started that game with a manic aggression that I could only aspire to have on a football pitch. It was absolutely unbelievable. I don't know whether he ran out of steam. I actually put it out there. Was this Pete Jerry McEntee asking the question? Because I wasn't sure if it was or not. But he got taken off at halftime. I'm not sure if there was an injury or, as Nathan said, maybe he was a bit cold. And I know Jerry, he wasn't cold. But I'm not sure what the issue was, but he started it really well. But as we said, Shea Fahey was the actual man of the match. Hayes had a quiet game. Fahey ran the show. In terms of off the ball qualities, Jerry McEntee, though, was 10 out of 10.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
I just have a note here, lads, because I feel like I said earlier on that the quality wasn't as good, and I don't think I backed it up when I said it. But it was just a moment that summed it up for me towards the end of the game. It was after Cairns' save, and Meade were chasing the goal. And Colm O'Rourke hoofs it from around the 45 over towards the sideline. And it goes over Colm Coyle's head, over his shoulders. Coyle receives it, turns his man, and hoofs it back over towards the square. Now, you can tell from the way that Coyle has hooked the ball from the sideline that the ball is going nowhere near the square. It ends up about 25 yards from the goal and in a Cork man's hand. But Jer Canning says, very good looking ball as the ball leaves Colin Coyle's boot. And if that's the standard that they were judging at back in 1990, and if that's what was good and a good looking ball, well, then I think we have to say that the quality is slightly improved these days. And you have the likes of Michael Murphy and Paul Flynn kicking the ball the way that they do.
Canning does lose his shit entirely as well when somebody completes a 20 metre kick pass at one stage. And it's like actually picking out a man and kicking the ball to him is just not something that you do in Gaelic football. Speed trumps everything.
There was no picking out a man at any stage. Like Mick Lyons, very early, does what great fullback does, and he rises up inside the square and he collects the ball. And you're thinking nowadays a fullback would just look to his side and hand pass out, and you try and build from deep. He gives it the most almighty welly. He kicks it from pretty much his own goal line to up on the halfway line, and that was his job. Like, but gives it straight to a Cork player. But it doesn't matter because he's got rid of it.
Do you know? It actually, lads, the game actually gave me more of an understanding of the lads that we know. And I'm not going to say my old fella does the same, but he's been guilty of shouting it before, let it in. He's been guilty of shouting that in the sideline quite a bit. And there's plenty of other men around the country and women around the country who are guilty of saying, let it in as quick as you can. I can understand why they wanted to let it in, because it worked back then, because it was a bit like hurling, let's say. Now, I might get in trouble in the office if I said this. I'm in the sanctity of an empty fifth floor here in Marconi House.
Yeah, no, yeah, you can definitely.
It's a bit like skill levels in hurling right now. You just hit it as far as you can to the corner and let the lads work away at it. That's what it was like.
Let's clip that. Tommy Rooney says modern day hurling is as unrequiring of skill as 1990s football is. Thank you for that soundbite, Tommy Rooney.
We're going to need soundbites, lads, over the next few weeks.
Let's roll on to trending, the trends that we noticed from 1990. There are loads here. I'll leave you to it, Nathan, if you want to kick this off.
Well, the amount of kicking was the obvious trend in the game. Freeze, for the first time, I think they were saying you could kick freeze from the hand. It was just recently brought in.
For
but
some
again,
freeze.
Even still, there were loads of freeze been taken off the ground from like deep inside their own half. But again, it just fed into the hoof it forward as far as you could. Like, there was no, if you had a free inside your own half, you weren't trying to work something. You were just trying to kick it as deep as you could into the opposition half. One of the things, maybe it's not the trending, is how bad Meath were in that first half. They were absolutely brutal. They had one 5 or 6 minute spell. But for a team that you like reflect on has been as a great team who'd won a couple of All-Ireland titles, like, they were shockingly bad. Colm O'Rourke, like 33 at that stage, knee not right, but you could just see the flickers of genius from time to time from him. I think we're probably all in agreement. If he was fit, it's a different result.
Yeah, but like, I don't buy the whole fitness thing for Colm O'Rourke this day. Like, his issue was his radar. Like, he won a few good balls, and he had two shocking wides in the game, Tommy. I'm sure even you'll agree with that.
Did you see the size of the knee brace on?
Ginormous.
Obviously, that's going to knock off the radar, like.
Okay, maybe it will. But I just don't see how you can actually be as involved as he is in the game, because he does get a good few touches on one leg. And if you're like, you're suggesting it was that bad, if you can't kick the ball over the parrot and you can't really run and get the ball, unless the man who's marking him, unless Niall Cahalan, well, maybe Niall Cahalan is quite slow, but I don't know. I think that was perhaps a little bit overplayed.
The other trend I would take from this morning is that Tommy Rooney can't talk about Meath football without going into full-on Meath accent. I've never heard him speak like this before.
I actually didn't realise that it happened, but it happens to me every time I go home.
Tommy, what other trends do you have, Hi?
Hi.
Is that how you do it?
My trend, lads. Look, quickly, slide tackles. I'm not saying to bring them back, but it was refreshing to see them. But the other trend I have, and it's a difficult one to explain, it's the juxtaposition of styles that were on show. Like, nowadays, people turn up in the same tracksuits, they wear the same gear. You know, various players are sponsored, but most of them all look, players look fairly similar nowadays, do you know what I mean? But back then, you had, as you said earlier on, Billy Morgan in his tracksuit, Sean Boylan in his white suit. You had Mick Lyons looking like James Bond compared to Niall Cahalan, who looked like he would just have to come out of a bush. Bernard Flynn. I have a lot more of an understanding of how good a footballer Bernard Flynn was after watching this. And Bernard Flynn was a stylish corner forward. He was a pin-up corner forward back in the 1990s. Like, Bernard Flynn,
Bernard
his style,
Flynn looks
his running,
than
his
did
grace. He actually does. One man I had never seen before. I actually don't think I've ever seen Martin Kearney before until I saw him at halftime. I've only ever listened to him.
Really?
I was like, who is that? Who is in the studio with Charlie McGrew? I didn't know that Martin Carney looked like that.
How is that possible?
You've never seen Martin Carney before.
I don't think. Well, maybe it's because it's 30 years ago. He just looks completely different. But
he doesn't.
I just didn't realize that was what Martin Carney looked like back in the. Like Michael Lester doesn't look any different, really.
Michael Lester is a handsome bastard in the year 1990.
Yeah, I'm saying he doesn't look any different nowadays. But Martin Carney, I wouldn't have known him. Anyways, the juxtaposition of styles. Colm Coyle's Under Armour.
Yes.
I don't know whether it was Under Armour back then or it was just a big pair of boxers, but like they were blue. Why were you wearing blue Under Armour with a green jersey? You don't do that.
Because you're Colm Coyle.
You don't do that. You've got to, you know, match up the colours here. Some players did it, some players didn't. So that was my thing, the juxtaposition of styles, and it was pretty refreshing to see that everyone was their own man. Back when men were men.
I think the evolution of shorts in the GAA has gone on like a little bit of a curve where like they started off in the very old grainy footage where they're quite low and then they reach kind of a peak where they get unbelievably short and then they've come back to being lowish now. That peak where they're at their shortest is at this very game, 1990 All-Ireland Football Final, Meath against Cork. There's one fella, I think it's the Meath centre-back, who is wearing his jersey tucked out and you can't even see his shorts. You can't even see his shorts because they're so short. That is what the trend is. Short shorts are absolutely all the rage. That is, like Colm Coyle is obviously astonished by how short the shorts were, and that's why he put on his blue skins underneath their shorts. So that's what I took from trending. In terms of most jarring, we kind of mentioned these a good bit already. No play acting, no malaise really at any point in the game. A lot of hoofing, as we've said. The freeze off the ground, the flags. But like just on the freeze off the ground, is the ball heavier? Because it looks heavier. It looks like a lot of them are struggling to get elevation on the ball. Or maybe.
Weirdly, I thought that they felt like they could hand pass it about 20 yards further than the current players can. But I think you're giving them a get out of jail free card there, because I think the shooting was just terrible.
Could I make one point on that? The kicking the freeze off the ground. Because it was enforced, a lot more players had to do it back then. Like nowadays, you can be guaranteed that you might only have three players on a football team who kick a ball over the bar from 45 yards. So you might actually, if everyone was forced to kick the ball off the ground, you might see a lot more players struggling to get it that far.
It's true, yeah. I just don't understand why there just wasn't better off-the-ground kicking when off-the-ground freeze were the thing at the time. Like, you would have thought, it just didn't. I just thought that there was moments where the skill execution was fairly good. I don't think power was an issue for these lads. And just to see a lot of these off-the-ground freeze just be completely fizzle out wide. Maybe the surface wasn't as good in Croke Park as well. I don't know, but it looked fine to me. So that's something kind of stuck out to me. We're going to move on then kind of to our final section here, to the sliding doors, which kind of gets into the context of this. I'm not sure what to make of this. I'm not sure whether this is a huge triumph or not for Cork, that they end up doing the double in 1990 and then the decade ends up becoming a year of huge turbulence in both codes. That surely if you're a Cork fan there in September 1990, you're like, right, this is going to be the year for Cork. And what, did they win another All-Ireland in either code before the end of the decade? Like, this is surely a nosedive in expectations from Cork, from where they are at this moment.
It's peak Corkness, is it, 1990?
Well, I would have thought so, but like, is peak Corkness then not to step up and say, right, well, we're going to dominate both of these sports. We're the big boys now, and we can do it in both codes. And then,
is peak Corkness not to put yourself in a position of greatness been just around the corner, and then to self-sabotage?
Yes, sorry, I see what you're saying. Of course it is. Well, sorry, peak Corkness would be being on the right side of arrogance. Of course, Corkness would never come into play with why they didn't win another few All-Irelands. But like, I don't know. Like, what is the context of this game? Like, is it a situation where Meath like come back and like it takes them a while, Tommy? I think you'll admit, for them to get back to this level again.
Yeah. Well, look, I did a bit of a study last night because I knew this question was going to come up because it's one of our topics, and after a bit of kind of work with mathematics and a bit of equations and science, I'm obviously not using my words very well here. What the sliding doors moment, the result ultimately of Meade losing the 1990 All-Ireland football final to Cork is that they beat Mayo in 1996. And that would not have happened. Mayo would have their All-Ireland title if Cork had lost that day and Meade had won.
Explain yourself.
Because it forced a transitional period of Meade football. We had an unbelievable minor team coming through. There was another 21 medals won as well. And it forced Sean Boylan to push out the legends of the late 80s and the early 90s. And over the next couple of years, they were phased out. And by 1996, you had Tommy Dowd, you had Ollie Murphy, you had New Blood, you had a lot of them now in, and Darren Fay, like a lot of those boys were in by that stage. And that is the only reason. Not Paddy Russell. Well, maybe he is Paddy Russell. Maybe if Paddy Russell had given Meade a few more frees that day and had beaten them in 1990, Mayo would have their All-Ireland.
I'll hand this over to you, Nathan.
Well, I think it's a bit much to associate the events of September 1990 with the outrageous cheating of the Meath team 6 years later. Like maybe
cheating.
The roots
I don't
of
think
it were
cheating.
In that match.
It was a fight. It was a row.
Yeah, instigated by the Meath players to try and get Mayo's best player sent off.
Hold on a second. Owen's neutral and he's done a documentary on it. Owen, was this cheating by Meade in 1996?
I would say Mayo were very hard done by,
Thank you.
But it's not cheating. Cheating is a very specific word here, lads.
Yeah, you've made such a horrendous point. We've actually lost Nathan Murphy. His Skype line has gone down because you're talking
honestly,
so much shite
about
it.
It's not that bad a point. It's not that bad a point. That game, that Meade losing, forced a transitional period in Meade football and it led to their dominance in 96 and 99, getting the three All-Irelands in the following decade. Cork, as you said, they sat on their history winning year and they went into the doldrums for 10 years.
Meath won the All-Ireland in 1996 because they were good enough to pick up one in what was a ragtag decade. Everybody who was good enough won an All-Ireland in the 1990s in both codes. Apologies, by the way, to any Cork hurling fans out there. I forgot about the 1999 hurling final, which, of course, Cork managed to win. Absolute classic, 13 points to 12 against Kilkenny. Somehow that slipped my mind when I said that they had a fallow decade. So they did it.
And Meath obviously beat Cork in the 99 All-Ireland football final as well.
There you go, actually, yeah. So at least he got back to finals in both codes throughout the decade. But I just think that, I don't know, like I don't know what this game tells us about the decade as a whole, but what we do know is that the following 10 years were a bit weird. They were great, but they were weird. We saw the emergence of a number of Ulster counties as legitimate contenders for successive years after that. Changed the landscape entirely in terms of how the whole country viewed Ulster football. But then it's very telling when you look at that 1990 final that the first thing we all said about it was the hard edge. This was the All-Ireland final where we're like, right, this is a tough game. You'd want to be able to handle yourself going out into that pitch. And the one thing that the Ulster counties managed to do is handle themselves going out into that pitch. So I think what this tells us about football at this point is that what matters more than anything else is your attitude and your determination and your ability to show a bit of grit. And that is why Ulster counties were so successful over the course of the 90s. And it's probably also why nobody managed to go back-to-back, because there was always a county beside you who was going to be more hungry to come back the following year and knock you off your perch. So like that's my theory on what this whole thing represents. I think it's a snapshot of a great rivalry between Cork and Meath at the time, but the legacy of it is that toughness is going nowhere in Gaelic football. It is going to be everywhere for the rest of the decade. And really, beyond that, when you look at how Tyrone and Armagh emerge in the following decade.
Mm. Yeah, it was the end of an unbelievable rivalry between Meath and Cork, I think, in 1990. And as you said, I'm really looking forward to actually looking back at the Ulster All-Ireland wins over the next couple of years in the early 90s, because that Down team were unbelievable to watch back then. I've seen one of the All-Ireland finals, the 91 one recently, and I'm looking forward to watching it back again. Let's go through the All-Ireland winners that year. Was it Down 91, Donegal 92, Derry 93? Did Down do it again in 94?
Down again in 94, yeah. And then you've got Dublin, Meath, Kerry, Galway, and Meath again.
Like, that was unbelievable how it was shared back then. I know it was known as revolution years in hurling. What was it in football? It obviously wasn't the devolution years, but like, what was it?
Well, I don't know. We'll come up with some sort of fancy name for that. Who was the team of the decade of the 90s? Downer Meath. If you're going by All Ireland's one, it's got to be one of the two of them, doesn't it?
It's going to be Meath, isn't it?
Because they got the finals,
and they kind of spread it across both sides of the decade. Down were only in the early 90s. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm completely wrong about that. And Down had an unbelievable team in the late 90s, and they were just unlucky. But there's no sign of any Ulster sides after 94. Well, I suppose there's Tyrone in 95. Who did Kerry beat in 97?
Mayo.
He's not back, is he?
He's not, no.
Okay. I'd say his phone died. He's been on the phone for the last 2 hours co-hosting the show.
We're going to wrap up very shortly, but I completely agree with your point about if you're bookending a decade, then you are the team of the decade. Just like, for example, if a team were to win the 2000 All-Ireland and say, I don't know, the 2009 All-Ireland, they are definitely the team of the 2000s. What team
won
those two All-Ireland?
That was a very different decade.
That's a debate that obviously has been well hammered on the show before. Over or underrated, Tommy, the 1990 All-Ireland football final?
Completely underrated, because when we said we were going to do this game, Kieran Shannon got back and David Sheehan got back in LMFM, and both lads warned me and said, you're not going to enjoy this one for the quality and show. And now at times the quality was putrid. At times it was good, But the thing is, the excitement level maintained. Like, I watched this game last night at 10 o'clock. I should have been going to bed. It was actually on live on Air Sport at the same time as we watched on YouTube completely randomly. I actually ended up watching the second half on Air Sport. I would watch it on YouTube just for the halftime analysis alone. But as I said, the quality wasn't great, but the absolute excitement throughout, the hardiness, the history around it, I think this final is actually underrated.
Well, I'm going to actually judge this on what the game was, and it's overrated. Like, the game is clearly overrated. When you
nobody rates it. Nobody thinks it's a good All-Ireland final.
I personally did. When you talk about Cork Meath, you're like, oh, great games of the late 80s. Actually, that's nonsense. They're not great games. It's not a great game. It's a great era. It's a great team, and there are great characters, and there's great toughness. And as an occasion, and as an enjoyable experience, it's a little bit underrated. I didn't know that you could actually enjoy a turgid affair as much as you possibly could, and maybe turgid's a bit strong. But I think as a contest, I think as an actual game, as a classic game, which is what we're here to rate, Tommy, I think it's overrated. I just don't think it was very good. But at the same time, there's such an enjoyable charm to it.
When was the last time you didn't fast forward a halftime analysis when you had the chance?
When was the last time I didn't?
You couldn't forward? like you wouldn't be able to fast forward this. It was just it was remarkable. I'm judging on the whole occasion. Okay, I know it's the classic game club. We're talking about the game. Are we going to give the game a rating?
Yeah, give me a rating there. I'm going for a 6.
On the quality of the game.
Yeah.
4.
4. Okay. So I've actually rated the game higher.
Overall 8. Quality 4.
The reason why we didn't fast forward halftime, Tommy, is because of Declan Ernie and the colourful tie and the tunes absolutely bopping in the middle of the field. Is there any final thoughts, Tommy, before we wrap?
I just really enjoyed it. If anyone is at a loose end over the next couple of weeks, if anyone has a bit of spare time in their hands, you could do a lot worse than going back and watching the 1990 All-Ireland Final. And if you do that, get in touch. Let us know what you think in terms of Secret Man of the Match or the trending topics. I loved it seeing Dr. Conn appear in the field every so often. I really enjoyed the shoulders, the punts, the hoofs, the shite solos. It was good crack.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to sum it. It's very, very good crack. Watch Back Yourself is all available on YouTube for anyone who hasn't seen the game. All the rest of our Classic Game Club episodes as well available on youtube.com/offtheball right now. This is what, episode 7, Tommy, I think? We're going to have another one for you tomorrow morning. It's going to be Celtic against Rangers from the year 2000, the 6-2 game for Celtic. That'll be your St. Patrick's Day Classic Game Club tomorrow. If you've got any suggestions as well, tweet us at offtheball, tweet Tommy or I. If you want to get in touch with us personally about any classic games that you may have watched, that you may see on YouTube or in Dailymotion or somewhere online, and we'll watch them back and review them here in the Off The Ball studio. That is our lot this morning for OTBAM. Thanks for that, Tommy. Nathan, of course, lost his battery there a little bit earlier on. We're back tomorrow morning. Make sure to follow us at Off The Ball to keep tuned to what we've got coming up tonight on the radio from 7 o'clock. Off The Ball will be live as well. Before we wrap this morning, here is Damien Delaney talking about Paolo Maldini. Good luck for now.
Were you a student of the game in the way Rooney was? Were you watching tape? Were you studying other players?
Yeah, I was, especially when I was younger, before I became a centre-half, really. I played a lot of football at like left-back or central midfield, actually this season, playing central midfield in League One 1 year. And I always thought that if I could learn as many positions as I possibly could, it gave me as many chances to play, whereas if I just kind of pigeonholed myself as to be a centre-back, if a club already had two really good centre-backs, well, then you're kind of killing yourself, really. So I thought, well, you know, they've got two centre-backs, I'll go and learn how to play left-back. So I played left-back for a season when I was at Hull. I played centre midfield for a season when I was at Hull. And I learned how to play left-sided three centre-backs as well. But very similar to what he was saying there, you know, you go on YouTube and you watch video and tape, and that's the way. There's no excuse for any young player now. With the advent of YouTube, you can go and put anybody's name into YouTube and you're going to get clips. You know, so I remember watching clips of Paolo Maldini and things like that, learning positioning. Ashley Cole was another big one, where you just learn, you know, defensively, where were they, how did they position themselves. And then when I was playing midfield, I just studied midfield players. Because I think if you can play as many positions as you possibly can, you give yourself as many, you know, potential opportunities to play football.
Fascinating, you're right, okay. So, Maldini.
Yeah, I know. As I was saying that, I realised you were going to come back at me and say...
And did you just watch it the once, or...
if you get clipped of Hull in 04, you'll see similarities.
Is that right? Okay, that was the one. Player of the year that year, I seem to remember,
wasn't
you?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. OTB.
AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.